end of the ninth chapter, then Krishna has asked Arjuna to always remember him, always think of him. And now in this chapter, in chapter 10, this is entitled The Opulence of the Absolute, Vibhuti Yoga. And Krishna then further describes his opulences here. Text 1. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "Listen again, O mighty armed Arjuna, because you are my very dear friend. For your benefit, I shall speak to you further, giving knowledge that is better than what I have already explained." Srila Prabhupada comments on this. Previously, beginning with the seventh chapter, the Lord has already explained his different energies and how they are acting. Now in this chapter, he explains his specific opulences to Arjuna. In the previous chapter, he has clearly explained his different energies to establish devotion in firm conviction. Again in this chapter, he tells Arjuna about his manifestations and various opulences. So it's like, now you've heard one should surrender to Krishna. Now Krishna tells more about himself. Because generally, the more you know of somebody, the more you can appreciate them. And the point from the previous one, his opening where he started to tell this was, "I'm telling this to you, Arjuna, because you are not envious." So now you can tell somebody more and more about yourself, and they appreciate you more and more, but there has to be that element of non-envy. Otherwise, if to that degree that the envy is there, to that degree, then you have to keep things very formal and not explain much. But to that degree that there is that surrender, you can explain so much more. So Krishna's opulence here, Bhurijan points out, is simultaneously noble and unknowable. So since so it's only when Krishna reveals himself. Means where we're from, the source of... Someone cannot understand their source because the source is beyond them. But if the source reveals themselves to some degree, then you can understand to that much how much they give. So here then, in this chapter then, basically that's what's happening, is Krishna being the source of everything is now revealing to Krishna how he is the source. Krishna then explains here, "Neither the hosts of demigods nor the great sages know my origin or opulences, for in every respect I am the source of the demigods and sages." Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur comments that if one puts forward the argument that the reason the demigods are unable to know Krishna is because they are too attached to sense gratification, Krishna defeats that argument in this verse. He says that even the sages who are detached from sense gratification cannot know him. No one can understand Krishna's origin and opulence without hearing from him or his devotees. Then result of this understanding. Text 3. "He who knows me as the unborn, as the beginningless, as the supreme lord of all the worlds, he only, undiluted amongst men, is free from all sins." So Baladeva Vidyabhushan points out that Krishna possesses all these three characteristics mentioned here. It means that he is unborn, beginningless, and the supreme lord of all the worlds. Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur points out that Brahma is unborn, aja, but he is not beginningless. So this description of Krishna, only Krishna has. No one else has this. Then he starts to describe... Bhurijan Prabhu points out that these are... Many contradictions come up here. So he's beginningless. He appears as the son of Vasudeva and Devaki. Though he's unlimited, he still is there as a small child. And Mother Jashoda is performing her pastimes. But we see that she has these ropes, and she's tying them together and trying to tie around Krishna's waist in the Damodar Leela. And it's always two fingers too short. So no matter how many ropes, it's always two fingers too short. But at the same time, the little black string that was around his waist with the bell on it, that's been tied before by Mother Jashoda, you know, for his protection and benefit and all that. But now, because she's going to chastise him and all that, she's going to contain him, now he's manifesting his unlimited nature. so she cannot do it. Text 4 and 5. Intelligence, knowledge, freedom from doubt and delusion, forgiveness, truthfulness, control of the senses, control of the mind, happiness and distress, birth, death, fear, fearlessness, non-violence, equanimity, satisfaction, austerity, charity, fame and infamy. All these various qualities of living beings are created by me alone. Srila Prabhupada mentions here, of whatever we find, good or bad, the origin is Krishna. Nothing can manifest itself in this material world which is not in Krishna. That is knowledge. Although we know that things are differently situated, we should realize that everything flows from Krishna. So his different energies are manifest in so many different ways. They are situated in different positions, but it's all coming from Krishna. That is the essential point. So one knows that whatever there is, it is all coming from Krishna. Prabhupada says here, all these qualities are manifest throughout the universe, in human society and in the society of demigods. Now for one who wants to advance in Krishna consciousness, Krishna creates all these qualities, but the person develops them himself from within. One who engages in the devotional service of the Supreme Lord develops all the good qualities as arranged by the Supreme Lord. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains Krishna's words. Krishna speaks, the knowers of Shastra cannot understand the truth about me by their own intelligence, because intelligence is born of goodness and the other modes of Maya. Even though they originate from me, the great sages and demigods are incapable of understanding me, who am beyond the modes. So whatever ability we have to understand is still coming through the modes. Intelligence is a material element. So it's very foolish to think that a material element, limited material element that's dead matter, is going to understand the unlimited sentient Lord. A very essential point is that you understand something that has a quality that can measure another, but you cannot understand with something that has no quality of the other, right? It doesn't have. So unless Krishna empowers that intelligence, unless the chit potency then enters the intelligence, one cannot understand. This was in a discussion by the sages on Tapaloka when they were discussing with Sanat Kumar, and they were asking him, how is it that when we say something is transcendental knowledge, but the person has spoke it with the material tongue, it is vibrating the air, material air, it's moving through the material ether, it's falling on the material sense organ of the ear, it is being digested by the mind and the intelligence. So where is the spiritual in this whole connection? What is spiritual about it at all? Why do we say that this is spiritual discussion? Because as far as we see, only material nature is acting. You know, Krishna points out, it's only the modes of nature acting. There's not something else going on. So then Sanat Kumar explains it, that is true, that is how the mechanics is working, but Krishna's chit potency, the knowledge potency, the transcendental knowledge potency, enters this. And because it enters this, then it becomes transcendental. So it becomes empowered. So if non-devotees sit around and discuss what they think is philosophy, it is still just the interaction of the modes. It's just the modes of goodness, passion, ignorance, and knowledge of the material world. They don't actually get beyond. So unless it's empowered, so that empowerment comes specifically, directly, when one is connected to the Sampradaya, the bona fide Sampradaya, then that chit potency is there. When it's outside that, then indirectly it may be connected through the proper shastras and proper methods that are given there, through karma, jnana, yoga. But still, but if one steps outside of that, atheistic people and those, they never understand, can't understand. They never actually come in contact with the spiritual nature. Though they think they are, because they think the words are spirit. But it's not. Spirit is something beyond. And Krishna explains here. Text 6. The seven great sages, and before them the four other great sages, and the Manus, progenitors of mankind, come from me. Born from my mind, and all the living entities populating the various planets descend from them. Stated in, Prabhupada points out here, As stated in the Brahma Samhita, Lord Krishna is the Supreme Lord. No one is greater than him. He is the cause of all causes. Here it is also stated by the Lord personally that he is the cause of all the demigods and sages. Even the demigods and great sages cannot understand Krishna. They can understand neither his name nor his personality. So what is the position of the so-called scholars of this tiny planet? No one can understand why the Supreme God comes to earth as an ordinary human being and executes such wonderful, uncommon activities. One should know, then, that scholarship is not the qualification necessary to understand Krishna. Here Krishna indirectly says that if anyone wants to know the absolute truth, here I am, present as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. I am the Supreme. One should know this. Although one cannot understand the inconceivable Lord who is personally present, he nonetheless exists. We can actually understand Krishna, who is eternal, full of bliss and knowledge, simply by studying his words in Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. Prabhupada mentions that these 25 personalities mentioned are the origin of all progeny in the universe. This is the meaning of gotra. As someone says that they are in a particular gotra, means that the seven great sages and the manus and the four kumaras, I don't think anybody can claim to go back to them, but the seven great sages and the 14 manus, then this is everybody can connect back to them. If that's so, someone is in a particular gotra, Kasyapa, or Angira, or all these different things. Everybody has their particular gotra that goes back to one of these sages. So that is the tradition in India, is that someone knows their family line. Then it's considered a pure family line. If you don't know your gotra, means that the line is not very pure, it's mixed. You know, it's what you call mongrel, or like that. But that one knows the line, then it's considered pure. So pure lines marry into other pure lines. But the point of this meeting here, because everybody based your whole status in society, much of it comes from this line that you are from, which, what is the gotra you are in. But here he's pointing out that they come from Krishna. So in other words, he is the central point. If you sit there right in the door, other people will not be able to get in. So there's plenty of space here. You know, we promise the devotees here, and also the ladies are there, you might give them some. See, there's plenty of space. Take some more space here, there. So then, everybody comes from them, but if you want to hear, no one understand that Krishna, then you must hear from the devotees, who have heard from the devotees, who have heard from Krishna, or from Krishna himself. Otherwise, one cannot understand transcendental. No way about it. Text 7. One who is factually convinced of this opulence and mystic power of mind engages in unalloyed devotional service. Of this, there is no doubt. So the point is if you understand Krishna's opulence, you'll engage in his service. Because he's the origin, he's the supreme, by serving him, then we actually come to our constitutional position, we become satisfied, everything. If we understand, we'll worship Krishna. If we don't understand, then we'll go on speculating and having other agenda. But as soon as we understand this, so now, Krishna then, now we come to the Chaturshloki of the Gita. And in here, these four shlokas basically sum up the whole Gita. In the first one here, then it mentions that by knowing this point, by knowing this, then one becomes a devotee. Text 8. I am the source of all spiritual and material worlds. Everything emanates from me. The wise who perfectly know this engage in my devotional service and worship me with all their hearts. So one Prabhupada mentions here that one who understands Krishna perfectly from a bona fide spiritual master will worship him with great love and attention. This knowing of his greatness leads to full surrender, and full surrender is followed by bhava, love. So we know the opulences, then we understand the material nature. And because Krishna's recommended this nishkam karma yoga, that means you need to know how material nature, your duties, and how the material nature is functioning. Because those duties must be known in combination with knowledge. So having knowledge of Krishna's opulences and how he works and how the material nature works, along with performance of prescribed duties, it brings one to the platform of liberation. This platform of, yeah. And here Prabhupada says to full surrender. And says full surrender is followed by bhava, love. So this means as sakti, one is fully attached to Krishna because of his wonderful qualities. So Krishna is mentioning some of his qualities. One is, appreciates Krishna's qualities, him as a person. Right? Before this stage, one is appreciating devotional service and the devotees. But here in Asakti, one actually is able to appreciate Krishna. By the grace of Krishna's service and Krishna's devotees, one actually appreciates Krishna. Then from that, there is full surrender. Ainandana tanuja kinkaram patitamam vishvame bhavam budo kripaya tava pada pankaja stiti duli sadarisham vichantaya. The one is, in this verse, surrendering to Krishna as his servant, right? Kinkaram, that I am your servant, and you just fix me as one of the dust at the atoms at your lotus feet. Stiti duli sadarisham vichantaya. Just a little dust. So that surrender is coming here. That full surrender is coming in this verse. Then that is followed by Nayanam Galara Suru Daraya Varanam Gadgaru Rudaya Gira. When will all these things come? So that's the platform of bhava, which is the beginning stages of love. Bhava, love. Followed by bhava and then puts love. So it can be its beginning stages and then that man matures into prema. So by understanding these, then one actually surrenders. It's not that without understanding these, one just automatically jumps to full surrender. We'll just sit around and just listen to Krishna's pastimes with the gopis. It's very nice as long as at this moment you also come to the platform of bhava, then there's no problem. But if not, if you restrict yourself only to that, then what is there to purify the heart? What is there to purify the heart? One may say, well, just doing these things. But we see that the residents of Navadvip and the residents of Braj, they are busy doing their prescribed duties. Right? They're not just sitting around. Right? Jatila is chastising Radharani and she's not, you know, all the other girls in the village in Yavat are up and she's still asleep. She should be up making cow dung patties. You know, there's a full day's work. You know, there's many things to do. She has to do so many things. So they're busy. Right? So they're doing their service and remembering Krishna. And whenever they have the opportunity, then they'll sit and discuss so much. But they're still engaged in activities. Though it is in pure love. Well, here in the platform of sadhana, we are trying to get to that platform. Sadhana means practice. Right? So the point is they're not talking about Krishna. Right? Here. Then the next point. They're not talking about Krishna as a sadhana, they're talking because of love. So if we're going to take just talking about Krishna all day as our sadhana, then we have to be on that platform to do that. That means we've come to the platform of giving up work. That means then there's no karma. That means the heart has to be pure. If the heart's not pure, how is one going to do that? So that means is okay, even we accept this point. Okay, we'll just sit down and just hear about Krishna all day. But that means we've renounced work. So right there, that cuts out, you know, all the grihasthas, at least. They cannot take up this process. Right? Because they have to do work. They have to do prescribed duties. They have to maintain the household. So possibly brahmacharis, vanaprasthas, sannyasis could just sit down and hear about Krishna all day. And just ignore all these lower stages of hearing about Krishna's opulence. But Krishna himself says, if you're not pure, you can't purify yourself in this stage. The platform of jnana, you cannot purify yourself. Now one may say, well, it's not jnana, it's Krishna's pastimes. But unless you have love, it's jnana. Because jnana means theory. Vijnana means realization. So when you hear about Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan and what he does, then what do you remember? All the facts and figures? Or all the love and exchange and deep rasa that's going on? No, we don't notice the rasa. We notice all, you know, this city, you know, Yavat and Nandagram and Jamuna and, Govinda Kund and Lalita Kund and Radha Kund and so many names and different personalities that are there. That's all Sambandha. Right? Like that. Because we remember that. But if we were tasting those other things, then we wouldn't. There wouldn't be no question of sadhana. It would be very natural that we're doing it. These residents of Vrindavan do it very naturally. Somebody doesn't have to tell them that they have to do it. So, therefore, it is still within the realm of practice, within the realm of understanding and learning about Krishna's glories. So Krishna says that one should do one's prescribed duties and know about Him. Then one can be free, one can be liberated. So therefore, Krishna says all these things to Arjuna. And Arjuna, who is hearing these, he asks to hear them again. Right? That'll come up. So the thoughts of my pure devotees dwell in me. Their lives are fully devoted to my service, and they derive great satisfaction and bliss from always enlightening one another and conversing about me. So here their thoughts are always in Krishna, their service is always in Krishna. So that fact of manmanab habamad bhakto madhyajimam namaskuru, that's accomplished. So in this way, then they're established very nicely in Krishna's service. Then they're always discussing about Krishna. Baladeva Vidyabhushan comments that madgata prana indicates that Krishna is the life of his devotees. They cannot live without him any more than a fish can live when taken from water. Krishna is their life and Krishna kata. Talking about Krishna is their nourishment. Thus devotees converse about Krishna amongst themselves in great love. They loudly chant Krishna's names and discuss his pastimes, form and attributes. The pure devotee's attraction to Krishna is as natural as the attraction between young boys and girls. So another point to be brought out on that, if it wasn't worth it, if one might say, okay, we accept that, we will do our work and all that, but when we hear about Krishna, we'll only hear about Krishna's intimate pastimes. Because one has said one should hear about Krishna's opulences, okay, we accept it as Krishna's opulences, we're not on the top platform, we're not actually getting deep prayojana benefits from it, you know, it'll be more the sambandha and the abhideya of actually just hearing about Krishna. But then, if that was the case, then why would personalities such as Baladev Vidyabhushan and Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, especially Vishwanath, Baladev, you could say, okay, he wrote Vedanta Sutra. So naturally, Bhagavad Gita also. Vedanta Sutra is the essence of the Vedic literatures. Gita is the essence of the Vedic literatures. You know, this is what he writes. Okay, so he's wrote a commentary on Gita. Very nice. Like that. That's for general. But why Vishwanath? Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, his books are just on the very fine, intimate points of devotional service. You want to know, okay, you're performing devotional activities, you want to know about the Abhideya Tattva, and you want to know if you're doing it properly, down to the hair-splitting point, he writes on it. So then why would he write on this, if it's just for other people? Because he generally is just writing specifically for the Madhyama. His works are very useful for the Madhyama. Kanishtha will get not so much benefit from his works. Uttama is beyond that. So why would he make a commentary? I mean, making all these very nice points. You see all these very inside points come. Because he also feels that this is a very important work, right? Along with the other acharyas. That they feel that this is an important work. Right? Bhaktivinoda Thakur has made a commentary. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. So the work is very important. That until you come to that platform of bhava, then one needs to understand these points. Otherwise, Maya is very clever, and she has got a trick for everybody at every stage. So one needs to know how to overcome that. And the Gita gives us that. So when we say the ABCs, we mean by which everything functions. Right? Means we may say, oh, ABCs are just beginning. We leave the ABCs. You try to read without the ABCs. You bring the great, you know, literary Nobel laureate and let them read a book without the ABCs. You can't do it. So the point is the whole function of your devotional life cannot work without the basics that are given in the Gita. It won't work. Because manmanabhava madbhakto madhyajimam namaskuru, that's what they're doing in the spiritual realm. So he's showing how to get from where you are today to the platform of those in the spiritual realm. So it's very useful knowledge. One has to be very, very careful. Just in the modern sense, you kind of tend to say that's lower, but you forget that without it, without what I learned in kindergarten, I can't do what I'm doing today. You know, as a PhD in literature, I cannot do it. Without the ABC, I can't function. But we gloss that over because we want to put the emphasis on the higher principles. But someone who actually knows what's going on, they can deal on all levels. In other words, the master. I mean, someone who can teach what they know on their top platform to someone who knows nothing, they will never gloss this over. They will say, you need this, and at every step, everything else is built on this. Everything is found. I am Krishna's servant. Right? That's the Swarup Lakshana, or the main form of the quality of a devotee that every devotee has in any sphere in the spiritual activities. They all have this one point, Swarup Lakshana, of I am Krishna's devotee. Now, based on that, then I may be a devotee in one particular rasa or another, or in one realm or another, in Vaikuntha or Dwarka or Ayodhya or Vrindavan, like this. But it's still based on that fundamental. You remove that fundamental, you don't have the spiritual realm. You have the material realm. In other words, we're taking the fundamentals and adding finer and finer and finer and finer details. It means that principle, because it's coming from Krishna, Krishna is unlimited. That principle is, I mean, that the details of that are also unlimited. You know, down to the point where each individual soul is different from every other individual soul. So that point of, I am Krishna's servant, that general point of all living entities that's appreciated and followed by the residents of the spiritual realm, then comes down to the point that each living entity, how they will apply that service to Krishna will be different. Even though it's a very minor degree, but it's different. So that much detail there are. So this one fundamental principle comes to the application of unlimited, because there's unlimited living entities. Like that. So we must appreciate how spiritual life functions and see the total picture. When we see the total picture, then one can actually function on the higher levels, because one can get oneself there. Otherwise, one cannot falsely jump. One has to take it stage by stage. Krishna is not jumping. Arjuna will say, well, he's a pure devotee. But Krishna is recommending for him Nishkam Karma Yoga, the platform of the Madhyam. He's saying, take this, do this, set example. That. And after hearing this, then Arjuna is going to say, now all my illusion is gone. So it means now he's on the platform of liberation, Brahma-Bhuta. That's full surrender to Krishna, that Prabhupada mentions here. Full surrender. And then he wants to know more, but for the benefit of everybody. Then text 10, to those who are constantly devoted to serving me with love, I give the understanding by which they can come to me. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur here defines Buddhi Yoga as Krishna's direct inspiration. That Krishna himself is inspiring the devotees. That's Buddhi Yoga. Because the devotee intensely desires to know Krishna, he gives them complete understanding of himself. And Srila Prabhupada discusses this point. A person may have a bona fide spiritual master and may be attached to a spiritual organization. But still, if he is not intelligent enough to make progress, then Krishna from within gives him instructions so that he may ultimately come to him without difficulty. The qualification is that a person always engage himself in Krishna consciousness and with love and devotion render all kinds of services. Srila Prabhupada stresses the wonderful inspiration Krishna gives to reciprocation with his pure devotees, loving worship. So now, how to remove all the ignorance, then Krishna explains in this next verse, text 11. To show them special mercy, I, dwelling in their hearts, destroy with the shining lamp of knowledge the darkness born of ignorance. Then Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains Krishna's thinking as follows. I become Atma Bhavastha, like a bee inside the whirl of the lotus. I become situated in their bhava. In my transcendental personal form, I reveal my qualities, and with the shining lamp of knowledge of these qualities, I destroy the darkness of ignorance of anadi karma, beginningless karma, which obstructs true knowledge and manifests as hankering for things other than me. So Krishna comes into the heart, and he gets situated in the mood of service of the devotee. And from that point, then he removes whatever ignorance may still be left. Right? So he, taking that, in other words, from the platform of that the devotee is nicely serving him, from there, that platform, he removes all this ignorance. And Srila Prabhupada explains here that one can go on speculating for millions of years, and if he is not devoted, he is not a lover of the Supreme Truth. He will never understand Krishna or the Supreme Truth. Only by devotional service is the Supreme Truth, Krishna, pleased, and by his inconceivable energy, he can reveal himself to the heart of the pure devotee. The pure devotee always has Krishna within his heart, and with the presence of Krishna, who is just like the sun, the darkness of ignorance is at once dissipated. This is the special mercy rendered to the pure devotee of Krishna. The pure devotee does not have to worry about the material necessities of life. He need not be anxious, because when he removes the darkness from his heart, everything is provided automatically by the Supreme Lord, who is pleased by the loving devotional service of the devotee. This is the essence of the teachings of Bhagavad Gita. By studying Bhagavad Gita, one can become a soul completely surrendered to the Supreme Lord and engage himself in pure devotional service. As the Lord takes charge, one becomes completely free from all kinds of materialistic endeavors. So then the devotee becomes completely dependent upon Krishna, and Krishna then takes care of everything for the devotee. He's taking care anyway, but the devotee may be endeavoring for his own arrangements. But as one surrenders to Krishna, Krishna removes all that, because the devotee has no other desire than Krishna, so he's always just thinking of Krishna, and Krishna takes care of all these other needs. If one has so many desires other than Krishna, Krishna is fulfilling those, but in his own way, in his own time, and with the purpose of removing those attachments. But here, if one gives up those attachments, Krishna within the heart removes those attachments, then one gives up all those desires, and then Krishna will take care. So Krishna is very, very nicely reciprocating here with the devotee. Then Baladeva Dibhushan, gives a point on how the living entity who has been covered by ignorance in time immemorial, anadi karma, can attain the true enlightenment, how he can actually come to the transcendental platform. The devotees themselves need not endeavor, no, not at all, this is Krishna speaking, to show them special mercy. I bestow upon them, but not upon any other yogis, the lamplight of knowledge. In other words, they don't have to worry about how to achieve my mercy, because I personally endeavor to give it to them. I am Atma Bhavastha, situated within the workings of their intelligence. Because the knowledge that I give them can be revealed only by me, it is not something in the material mode of goodness. It is even something distinct from the normal transcendental knowledge arising from devotional service. With this lamp of knowledge, I destroy their ignorance. Because I personally destroy their ignorance, why should they have to endeavor? According to my own words, to those who always worship me with devotion, I carry what they lack and I preserve what they have. I accept as my personal burden the supply of all their necessities, both material and spiritual. These four verses are the essence of Bhagavad Gita, and they are thus called Chaturshloki Gita. They remove the distress of all living beings and bring about all auspiciousness. So So even by performing devotional service, when we perform devotional service, then we are gaining knowledge. By that detachment, knowledge is gained. But now Krishna is saying he himself personally gives the knowledge even beyond that. Because that knowledge that you gain by performing the devotion and detachment is a knowledge of how we're not the body, we're not part of the material world, there's nothing here to enjoy. You know, in other words, whatever we need to bring us to the platform of liberation, to Brahma-Bhuta. But here Krishna says, when one endeavors like that, and he is very pleased, and he personally enters the heart and reveals these things. So he gives the knowledge beyond that. In other words, the other is giving how to detach yourself from the material world. And Krishna here is giving how to attach yourself to him. Right? So when Krishna is pleased with our service, right? Means in other words, those whose thoughts always dwell in Krishna, their lives are fully dedicated to me. Those who are constantly devoted to serving me with love. Then Krishna shows them this special mercy. Right? Yeah, so this first part was, I am the source of all spiritual and material worlds. Everything emanates from me. The wise who perfectly know this engage in my devotional service and worship me with all their hearts. So one who knows how Krishna is the source of everything, in other words, all the opulences that are discussed here in the Gita, then he takes up the devotional service and worships Krishna with all their hearts. Then such a devotee, because of this, then Krishna enters their heart and then reveals this knowledge. Like that. Does that make some sense? So in this way we can see the complete workings of the... So Krishna is saying, you follow this Nishkam Karma Yoga, and, you know, means you hear about him, touch Trinu, and then take up this devotional service. And he recommends Nishkam Karma Yoga. Then by performing that, those activities, with detachment and knowledge, then one gets this understanding that to detach oneself from the material nature and always engage oneself in Krishna's service. Then when one does that, Krishna is pleased, and then he, from within the heart, then he reveals all these things. He's already there as Paramatma. So all these opulences are there very nicely. But now, here, Krishna says he himself will reveal these things. These transcendental means, these personal things about himself. Because otherwise one cannot know. Right? The jnani can know about the material world. Because it's there in the scriptures. It takes him many, many lifetimes. Generally millions of lifetimes, or at least thousands. But the devotee, within one lifetime, sure, not even just a part of a lifetime, gains that same knowledge that the jnani knows. And Krishna reveals beyond this what is happening with himself personally, the spiritual realm and all this. So this is all going on. Krishna's recommending all this. Then Arjuna, after hearing this, then he continues. Arjuna said, excuse me, not continues, he hasn't spoken since the 8th chapter. Arjuna said, you are the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the ultimate abode, the purest, the absolute truth. You are the eternal, transcendental, original person, the unborn, the greatest. All the great sages such as Narada, Asita, Devala, and Vyasa confirm this truth about you. And now you yourself are declaring it to me. So interesting here is Arjuna is appreciating this pureness of Krishna, pavitram paramam. And in this way the devotee becomes pure. Right? Means Krishna's come to the world. We discussed this point a few times, is that Krishna is coming to the world and he is acting in the world out of duty for setting good example. With a detachment. And Krishna is asking the devotee to act in this material world, performing prescribed duties with detachment. And Krishna, why he comes, he mentions a few things. Destroy the demons, he does that. He encourages the pious, yes, he does that. But the real reason he comes is to associate with the devotees. And the devotees then who are doing these same things, doing their duties like Krishna does, without the attachment like that, are always thinking of Krishna. So because the devotee is doing like what Krishna does, Krishna comes like this. It's reciprocal. So Krishna is asking that we do like he does. He comes here to do his duties, to set example, and to always think of the devotees. And the devotees perform their prescribed duties with detachment, always thinking of Krishna. So then we see that it becomes, that because of the similar nature, therefore then one can associate with Krishna. One is elevated to that platform. Is that understood? This is what's going on. So this whole Gita is trying to bring one to that point of understanding Krishna and his wonderfulness and his activities. Then we can perform in the same kind of mood, though as servant. He is doing it as the Lord. We are doing it as the servant. Then he continues, O Krishna, I totally accept the truth, all that you have told me. I totally accept as truth all that you have told me. Neither the demigods nor the demons, O Lord, can understand you personally. So Baladev Vidyabhushan, Prabhupada says that Arjuna is teaching us the mood in which we should accept Krishna's words, his instructions that he's giving here in Gita. Baladev Vidyabhushan comments that Arjuna calls Krishna Keshava, and then he breaks it down here. K refers to Lord Brahma, Sha to Lord Shiva, and Va indicates that Krishna binds Brahma and Shiva with knowledge of himself. He thus makes them his devotees. How then can they independently understand Krishna? What to speak of him being known by less powerful demigods or demons? Therefore only Krishna can truly know himself, and Arjuna will point this out in the next verse. So he says, neither demigods nor the demons. So Krishna is revealing this knowledge to Brahma and Shiva. And they only, in this way, because of their devotion and this relationships of this tesham satata yuktanam, or this, what's it, evanukam partam, then everything's being revealed to them. So if they can only gain it by Krishna revealing to them, then what about those under them? Under Brahma is all the demigods, under Shiva all these demons, they always go to him. So how they'll understand? If who they worship and revere cannot understand, then there's no question that they can understand if who they revere cannot understand. 15. Indeed, you alone know yourself by your own internal potency. O Supreme Person, origin of all, Lord of all beings, God of gods, Lord of the universe. Please tell me in detail of your divine opulences by which you pervade all these worlds. O Krishna, O Supreme Mystic, how shall I constantly think of you, and how shall I know you? In what various forms are you to be remembered, O Supreme Personality of Godhead? Yeah, because Krishna's mentioned in this last verse, manmana bhavamadbhakta, manmana, so you should always think of Krishna. So Arjuna's saying, how should I think of you? How are all the various ways I should think about you? And Prabhupada points out that Arjuna is asked about the Krishna's all-pervasiveness for the common person. Because of being a devotee, then the superior devotee is concerned not only for his own understanding, but for the understanding of all mankind. So Arjuna, out of his mercy, because he is a Vaishnava, a devotee, is opening for the common man the understanding of all, the all-pervasiveness of the Lord. Because we can relate when you give us a material example. Right? We can see that. We can see something there. And then we can go from the gross and understand the subtle behind it. But now we understand that what is behind it is Krishna. Text 18. O Janardana, again please describe in detail the mystic power of your opulences. I am never satiated in hearing about you, for the more I hear, the more I want to taste the nectar of your words. Then Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur points out that Krishna at this point may have an objection. He may say, but haven't I already said that all things are my opulent expansions? In my statement, I am the source of all things, aham sarvasya bhagavo. And haven't I already described devotional service in my words? Understanding this, the wise worship me. Arjuna responds to this in the verse beginning Vistarena. That's this verse we just read. O Janardana, with the sweet nectar of your instructions, you are generating in me a greed to hear, thus agitating me and impelling me to beg for more. What else then can I do but beg? While imbibing the nectar of Krishna's instructions, Krishna's ears are acquiring the ability to taste, as if they were tongues. So now Krishna will start to describe his opulences for the rest of this chapter. Text 19. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "Yes, I will tell you of my splendorous manifestations, but only of those which are prominent, O Arjuna, for my opulence is limitless." Here he begins, he uses the word hanta, and hanta here is mentioned as a form of address that is very, very kind, very tender, very close, like that. So he's saying that, yes, at your request I will speak, but it's very intimate. So he starts from as the super soul. "I am the super soul, O Arjuna, seated in the hearts of all living entities. I am the beginning, the middle, and the end of all beings. Of the Adityas, I am Vishnu. Of lights, I am the radiant sun. Of the Marus, I am Marichi. And among the stars, I am the moon." Means these verses, we see he's either taking a group, showing how he's the best among them, like that, or he's the essence of something, like that. So here, the Adityas, he is Vitru. Adityas are all the descendants of Aditi. Right? So of all the different children of Aditi, then the best is Vamanadev, who is Vishnu. Lights, he is the sun. Maruts, he is Marichi. Among the stars, I am the moon. So of all the different stars in the sky, then the moon is the most powerful, most prominent. Has the, like when you're doing the chart, dealing one, well, one is you can see it in the sky, naturally it is the most prominent. But when you're dealing with astrology, then the moon has the most influence of all the stars. And as it moves around, it has so much influence. So you always have to know where the moon is and what its influence is. "Of the Vedas, I am the Samaveda. Of the demigods, I am Indra, the king of heaven. Of the senses, I am the mind. And in living beings, I am the living force, consciousness. Of all the Rudras, I am Lord Shiva. Of the Yakshas and Rakshasas, I am the Lord of Wealth, Kubera. Of the Vasus, I am Fire, Agni. And of mountains, I am Meru. Of priests, O Arjuna, know me to be the chief, Brihaspati. Of generals, I am Kartikeya. And of bodies of water, I am the ocean. Of the great sages, I am Bhrigu. Of vibrations, I am the transcendental Om. Of sacrifices, I am the chanting of the holy names, Chapa. And of immovable things, I am the Himalayas." So Prabhupada points out in his purport here, "Of all sacrifices, the chanting of Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, is the purest representation of Krishna." So this is interesting, because in our previous discussions, we note that in all of the yoga systems, whatever there is from each of the age, and each of the yoga systems, all the yuga dharmas and the yogas, the chanting is the essential point. You're always doing chanting in all of these, whether it's by chanting Omkara, chanting the Vedic mantras, chanting the deity worship mantras. You know, whatever stage one's at, there's always chanting is there. But now we see that the essence of that is the chanting, Krishna points out here. And then in this age, when one is so unfortunate, he just gives that. Right? Just gives the holy name. You just do this. Forget all the other stuff. Just do this. That's the name. Text 26. "Of all trees, I am the banyan tree. And of the sages, amongst the demigods, I am Narada. Of the Gandharvas, I am Chitrarata. And among perfect beings, I am the sage Kapila." Mentioning, interesting here, is Nara means mankind or spiritual. And da means giving or granting. So Narada is one who gives the understanding of God, or gives God to everyone. Like that, Narada, one who gives the, you know, spiritual. Of 27. "Of horses, know me to be Uchai Sharava, produced during the churning of the ocean of nectar. Of lordly elephants, I am Airavata. And among men, I am the monarch. Of weapons, I am the thunderbolt. Among cows, I am the Surapi. Of causes for procreation, I am Kandarpa, the god of love. And of serpents, I am Vasuki. Of the many-hooded Nagas, I am Ananta, and among the aquatics, I am the demigod Varuna. Of departed ancestors, I am Aryama, and among the dispensers of law, I am Yama, the lord of death. Among the Daitya demons, I am the devoted Kalad. Among subduers, I am Time. Among beasts, I am the lion, and among birds, I am Garuda. Of purifiers, I am the wind. Of wielders of weapons, I am Rama. Of fishes, I am the shark. And of flowing rivers, I am the Ganges. And Baladev Vidyabhushan comments that the Rama referred to here is Parasaram, because Krishna is explaining his vibhutis, his opulences, not his incarnations. Parasaram is a living entity, empowered Shaktivesh to wield weapons. So, Gopalbhatta Goswami, or also, Prabhupada mentions it when he's discussing the the Dasavatar, this song, Jayadev's song. Then you have Raghupati Rama, you have Janmadagnya Rama, and you have Sankarsana Rama. So all three are Ramas. So there's three Ramas. So there's Baladev, who's Sankarsana Rama. Then you have Lord Ramachandra, who is Raghupati Rama. Then you have Parasaram, who is Jamadagnya Rama. So here, when he says Rama, means specifically Parasaram. Though we see all of them carry weapons. Balaram always has his plow. Ramachandra always has his bow. But he's specifically talking here of his opulences. So this means Parasaram, just the ability to wield weapons. Because you don't, when you think of Parasaram, you don't think of anything else. His only pastime is that of wielding a weapon. But in the others, then they are Lila avatars, so they do so much. But here, he just has the opulence of the Lord of using a weapon. And we see how he can use it, you know, so nicely. 32. Of all creations, I am the beginning and the end, and also the middle. O Arjuna, of all sciences, I am the spiritual science of the self. And among logicians, I am the conclusive truth. Yeah. So in text 20, Krishna was also saying he's the beginning, middle, and end of all beings. So Baladev Vidyabhushan points out that in this verse he was referring to referring to all sentient beings. Here, however, Krishna says that he is also the beginning, middle, and end of every non-sentient creation. So it means whatever there is, he is the beginning, middle, and end. That. Also, this point on I'm the spiritual science of all sciences. I'm the spiritual science of the self. You have 14 books of knowledge. So, in these 14 books, then 13 of them deal with the material world: the Vedas, the Sanskrit, the astrology, the ritual, the histories, the logic, and the Dharma Shastras. And then the 14th is the Vedanta, or the transcendental knowledge. So he says, of all these books of knowledge, he is the transcendental knowledge. And then he says, among logicians, I'm the conclusive truth. So in Nyaya, then you have different ways that you can argue. So this system of Vada means, Krishna says he is Vada, means the conclusive truth. Means two parties sit down and they discuss and they want to come to the conclusive truth. Each one's not trying to outdo the other. They just want to know what is the truth. So they discuss very nicely according to the rules. And they actually come to a conclusion. Well then, when you have Vidanda and Jalpa, then you're not doing that. Vidanda is just quibbling. It's destructive argument. So here when it was used before, Krishna said, the quibblers means those with destructive arguments. And he says the quibblers won't accept that someone is still a sadhu even if they've fallen down or had difficulties. Quibbler here just means not that they're just nitpicking. It means they're trying to destroy. So it means whatever you say, they'll just say something to destroy. It doesn't matter if it supports what they say, doesn't support what they say. It has anything to do with it. Their only purpose is to win. That's all. And Jalpa is the same thing. Jalpa is you just use deceptive things. You say this, you say that. It means you'll say anything. Your whole purpose is just to win. And you don't care about conclusion because it's just mental speculation. That's the fun anyway. So Krishna says of all these forms, of Nyaya, because Nyaya, everybody's talking and arguing and this and that. He's not any of these. He's only those, when they sit down, they want to know what is the truth, discuss, come to actual conclusions based on the Shastra. That is Krishna. All other forms of argument are just useless, or Maya. 33. Of letters, I am the letter A. And among compound words, I am the dual compound. I am also inexhaustible time. And of creators, I am Brahma. I am all-devouring death. And I am the generating principle of all that is yet to be. Among women, I am fame, fortune, fine speech, memory, intelligence, steadfastness, and patience. Like that. And then he points out, death is described here as sarvahara, because it takes away everything. Nothing is left without it. And then in the Sanskrit language, then many things are classified as feminine. So these different qualities are also. The Prabhupada explains in his purport. The seven opulences listed, fame, fortune, fine speech, memory, intelligence, steadfastness, and patience, are considered feminine. If a person possesses all of them or some of them, he becomes glorious. So these are very special of all the qualities that are there. 35. In other words, of all the feminine qualities, all qualities in that listed as of all the feminine qualities and things connected with women that are listed, then these seven are Krishna. Anyone who has these is considered glorious. 35. Of the hymns in the Sam Veda, I am the Brihatsama. And of poetry, I am the Gayatri. Of months, I am Margashirsha, November, December. And of seasons, I am the flower bearing spring. It's interesting. Margashirsha, that's Keshava month. It's the first of the Vedic calendar. It's also, it's interesting, I was just reading the other day, is that's when the clouds become pregnant, beginning of the year. So, and then the, what do you call it? The pregnancy lasts until the rainy season, then they deliver the rain. So they give all kinds of symptoms how you can tell if the clouds have actually become pregnant, or whether there's a miscarriage, and then there won't be any rain that year, or improper monsoon, because everything's dependent upon the rain. So the beginning of the whole life, it means the rain is, grains, everyone subsists on grains. Grains come from rains. Rains come from the sacrifice. So when the clouds become properly pregnant, then there's going to be proper grains, and then everyone's going to live very nicely. So the beginning of the year here is this Margashirsha, because that's when all these things, everything starts nicely from this point. Same time as we see then of seasons, he's the flower-bearing spring. That's when all the life comes and everything starts to manifest. Everything wakes up, comes to life. Then. 36. I am also the gambling of cheats, and I am the splendid, I am the splendor. I am victory, I am adventure, and I am the strength of the strong. Ooh, one thing came up, I forgot. Just to point back from that last verse of it's not so. Okay, I'll move on. Of the descendants of Rishni, I am Vasudeva, and of the Pandavas, I am Arjuna. Of the sages, I am Vyas, and among great thinkers, I am Bhushana. Among all means for suppressing lawlessness, I am punishment, and of those who seek victory, I am morality. Of secret things, I am silence, and of the wise, I am the wisdom. Interesting is that he is victory, so that taste one gets of victory, but for those who are looking for victory, he is morality. So someone who seeks victory in a very according to proper morality, then that is Krishna. Even within victory, still that. Also here he says, I am the strength of the strong, but in the seventh, then he mentioned he is the strength of the strong, it's devoid of passion. You know? In other words, the strength is being used for in the proper way to protect, to in other words, for some beneficial thing, not just someone becomes crazy and strong. In other words, King Kong and Godzilla would not be considered, you know, that would not be considered in this description of the seventh chapter, like that. But in any case, their strength is coming from Krishna. like that. So next time you see King Kong climbing up the Empire State Balloon or like that, then you can remember how that strength is coming from Krishna. Furthermore, O Arjuna, I am the generating seed of all existences. There is no being, moving or non-moving, that can exist without me. So Burijan points out that with this verse, because this is basically the conclusion of all those details, that now says anything, being, moving, non-moving, cannot exist without him. So anything you see, you can actually think Krishna is the basis of this. He points it out. Whatever we can think, the existence of this person, this tree, this building, this universe rests upon Krishna. Nothing exists without him. So like that, anything you can see, if anything's nice, very attractive, beautiful, glorious, anything, it's all coming from Krishna. 40. O mighty conqueror of enemies, there's no end to my divine manifestations. What I have spoken to you is but a mere indication of my infinite opulences. Know that all opulent, beautiful, and glorious creations spring but from a spark of my splendor. But what need is there, Arjuna, for all this detailed knowledge? With a single fragment of myself, I pervade and support this entire universe. So Prabhupada gives a summary of this entire chapter here. If, however, one thoroughly studies the differences, different descriptions of the opulences and expansions of Krishna's energy, then one can understand without any doubt the position of Lord Shri Krishna and can fix his mind in the worship of Krishna without deviation. The Lord is all-pervading by the expansion of his partial representation, the Supersoul, who enters into everything that is. Pure devotees, therefore, concentrate their minds on Krishna, in Krishna consciousness in full devotional service. Therefore, they are always situated in the transcendental position. Devotional service and worship of Krishna are very clearly indicated in this chapter, in verses 8 through 11. That is the way of pure devotional service. So all these manifestations here are being manifested by the Supersoul. And the Supersoul is just a partial manifestation of Krishna. Right? Krishna is manifested as Baladev, then as Mahanarayan, then as Garbhodakshaya, Karanodakshaya Vishnu, then Garbhodakshaya Vishnu, then Kiridakshaya Vishnu. Right? So this is the fifth expansion. He's only manifesting a portion of Krishna's opulence, because that's all it takes to run the material world. So that's all he's manifesting, a portion. And this opulences are just coming from a portion of himself, his expansion. So how much more wonderful is Krishna himself, who is explaining all this? Then, just thinking, if you like, we can go on to the 11th, because the 11th is basically the same. Or do we just, or should we go into questions? What do you suggest?
I have a question.
Okay, then let's go.
Right now it's a super song. And also explains that they see dwelling from within me. Actually enters into the heart. So the devotee and the realization of this person often destroys the power. The question is that we often hear, just a few days ago in Bhagavatam also, stated that Krishna enters into the heart and gives way of the misgivings. And many, many times we read this, Krishna enters the heart and flings away. And other times we understand he's already in the heart all the time. But sometimes it says he's sitting next to the individual soul, or the super soul sits side by side. And other times it says he's within the heart. So When Krishna's speaking out, is it a separate expansion? When Krishna actually helps the devotee, or is it? Does he have more than one feature of himself when he's imparting knowledge?
It doesn't appear here, because both Vishwanath and Baladev make this point of Atma Bhavastha, meaning that he enters into their consciousness, or enters into their intelligence, like that. And in this way he reveals. So he's always there. It's not, he's always in the heart. But it's just that when the devotee endeavors like this and turns their attention towards him, then he enters their consciousness and enters their intelligence. So then they're able to always think of him and always know how to act for his, you know, for serving Krishna. Like that. That seems to be what, because both of them make this point. Krishna's thinking, I become Atma Bhavastha, like a bee inside the whorl of a lotus. I become situated in the bhava. Or no, not bhava, bhava. In my transcendental personal form, I reveal my qualities, and with the shining lamp of knowledge of these qualities, I destroy the darkness of ignorance of anadi karma, beginningless karma, which obstructs true knowledge and manifests as hankering for things other than me. So it seems he enters there and reveals. And Vishwanath and Baladev then points out that he carries what they lack and he preserves what they have. I accept as my personal burden the supply of all their necessities, both material and spiritual. So the spiritual needs of understanding Krishna, and that Krishna himself personally takes care. He personally takes care of that. So now this also answers another question. Another question that arises basically from the camp of these sahajiyas. Unfortunately, since the sahajiyas don't bother reading Gita, then they never get this answer. But Krishna says here he takes care of both material and spiritual necessities. So that one of the necessities is this understanding Krishna being revealed to them. And then advancing through there, understanding who they are, how to serve Krishna, how to deal in their service. So Krishna says, I will take care of this. I will supply all their necessities. So Krishna is arranging that. Like that. But they will think, no, someone else has to supply it. Like that. But here, Krishna is supplying. Krishna will take care of the living entity. So all perfections are there from performing devotional service. One doesn't need anything outside devotional service. So if we're performing according to the directions of the acharyas, based on Krishna's instructions here, then everything becomes revealed. The heart means where the consciousness is. The consciousness, the living, the life airs, the five life airs, the super soul is there, the living entity, then the mind, the intelligence, the false ego, all those things are in that place. So that's right in the center, right where the chakra is, the heart chakra is. Right next to that, like touching that area, is the pump, the heart. So all the blood goes through the heart, and because that goes through the area of the chakra, the chitta, then it becomes the consciousness of the living entity spreads throughout the body through the blood. Prabhupada points that out to the performer. Is that when the blood is there in the body, you're conscious of the whole body. If you stop the blood to any one point, you're not conscious of that point anymore. You know, if your foot goes to sleep because there's no blood, you can't feel your foot anymore. So you're not conscious of it. So the consciousness moves through the blood. That's because the blood goes next to the heart. Plus it picks up energy from going next to the living entity. So it doesn't mean the heart. That's why you can change hearts, and it doesn't change the soul. You know, someone can have a heart transplant, and it's not that a new soul is put in. The same one's there, because that actually has nothing to do. It's just another mechanical part of the gross body. And, it's separate. But they're right next to each other. And the heart becomes very much affected by the, you know, emotions and that happen within the citta, you know, because the mind is there and the mind experiences all the emotions, you know, at least the material emotions. And yeah, and also that, yes, it's, as the mind becomes purified, it experiences the spiritual emotions. So that can affect the heart also. It can go faster or slower, you know, so many different things can happen. But it's because of its proximity to the heart where all this is situated. Yes.
Maharaj, in America on one talk show, they had that Deepak Chopra, who headed up Maharishi's program, as a guest. So in the audience on the show, they had a lady, especially, they asked a question about the soul and in the region of the heart, the whole thing like this. And then they had this lady, and she had a heart transplant. So the talk show host, he said, asked the lady to come up, and she narrated her experience that it was just a very ordinary kind of little old lady, middle class, but one Hell's Angel type had been killed by his modified, and because he's very healthy in the condition, they'd taken his heart, and she had received this heart in her heart transplant. But his habit was, his addiction was, you could say, was his Kentucky Fried Chicken nuggets. Now, a lot of people in America don't eat junk food. And I think we'll all agree, especially as devotees, that's right at the top of the list of junk food. So she in her whole life had never been near one of these Kentucky fast food outlets. But on recovering from the operation, she found herself inexplicably driving into a Kentucky outlet and buying a big packet of these nuggets. So then the talk show host said, how is it that when the physical heart is transplanted, here this lady suddenly develops a craving for something she's never been remotely interested in? But was the craving of, you could say, let's put it this way, the heart's previous owner. So the talk show host asked Deepak Chopra to answer this, and as far as I recollect, he just waffled. He never really explained anything in a convincing way. But it's a very interesting question, because, like you described, the soul is in the proximity of the physical heart. So what would we say to such a question? Why did this lady suddenly develop this addiction? You know, the addiction of the previous element of the heart.
One question I would have, just to clarify it more clearly, when she would go to the Kentucky Fried Chicken outlet, would she ride on a chrome chopped Harley?
No, I think she drove Horace
Minor. Oh, I see. Okay.
Did she develop a federation for leather gear?
Yeah, okay. She should go down there in her colors. Basically, it's because Krishna says that depending upon the subtle body, then you develop a certain, all the senses then manifest around the mind. Because of the consciousness, the ego, then that influences the mind, which then all the senses gather around. So then they'll have their particular likes and dislikes. Now, and that creates the, so the senses means the whole gross body is created. So when you have somebody, so two aspects would be there. We can explain it from two aspects. One is that the particular predilection for, you know, foodstuffs of the Hell's Angel then is there in his gross body because it is subtle. Right? So it means, and we see what the gross, when the gross body is hungry, it affects the subtle body. You know, we decide we want to eat. But we may not think about it until the gross body makes manifestations, you know, this, you know, grumblings in the stomach and other things. So the subtle is also affected by the gross. That the surroundings that we're in will affect how we react and think. So you take a part of someone's body that has been created because of a particular mentality and desires. So that can also still have some influence on the lady. But all it was is one thing. I'm sure he had many particular likes and dislikes and idiosyncrasies, but only one, I guess, was his most prominent.
Right.
You know, maybe just before he died, he was holding his...
He was driving down the road on his Harley, eating out of a...
Yeah, so probably something happened, and either it started to slip, and when he tried to adjust his tub of nuggets, then he had an accident. So his final thing that he thought of was his Kentucky Fried Chicken nuggets. So this would be the most prominent feature in his life at that moment, naturally would create then two reactions. One, it would leave an impression probably on all the, you know, on his body. So then the lady who received his heart then got that aspect. And on him, then it created for him that he, of course, because one, whatever Krishna said, whatever you worship, then you go to that. So in his next life, then sure enough, he also became a Kentucky Fried Chicken nugget. You know, like this. So one goes to where one thinks at the time of death. So probably because that was so prominent, only that aspect came out. Second thing is that would be the mechanical side of it. Then the other thing was, is probably within her karma and all that, that at a certain point in her life, she would develop a taste for, you know, junk food. And so it was just arranged by this particular mechanical arrangement, you know. So it's there. It's not the soul. Because otherwise, if it was the soul, then you would see her out on her Harley and driving around. But it wasn't. It's not that another soul came in. Otherwise, you wouldn't have this lady there.
Another idea could be that also to die such an inauspicious, violent death as that automobile accident.
Ah, this is a very...
Life, yeah. He could have taken a subtle body-type birth as a ghost or something.
Right.
And still be...
Yeah, influence. That's very important point. That would be a third, aspect, is that because that's why it's very, generally very important that after someone dies, unless they're very advanced, you know, very detached, in other words, unless they're detached from the material body, then they're burned. Because then the soul has a tendency to remain attached to the body and won't go away. That's why graveyards and that are a little spooky, because the people are very attached to their bodies because now they don't have one. So the last one they had is the one that's buried in the ground, so they hang around. So now here, if you have, he's in a ghost form, the only thing left of him, you know, of any that's really happening is his heart, and this lady's got it. So he might like to hang around. And so one should think twice as a devotee about receiving transplants of various things because, you know, the other person may hang around because of their mutual attachments to the same particular organ. But that's also a very interesting point. Very good point. But that the soul doesn't change. You see is that it's very interesting. Is if you just take it from the point of modern science, is they are coming across this thing, and the more they get into it, the more they become bewildered. But this chain of DNA, RNA, so it seems when they can understand is written into it is all how one's material qualities and you know one's intelligence and all these different things. And so then, so your different tastes and desires and that would also be written into this code. So now if you get the heart of someone else, that has a different code written in it than what your rest of your body. So something may also then influence like that. And that's also another way that one could mention.
I found it quite impressive how these talk show hosts, they do so much research before the program to come up even like a metaphysical question like that, to come up with what's actually quite a tricky. And that metaphysical question was a really broad, just deep like chocolate, just what was on about this and that, but nobody was very savvy about it. But his arms, I think, probably even included him. Wow, I wish I was prepared for that.
Yeah. In other words, that he knows Ayurveda, right? Isn't that his thing?
Right.
So, but the point is Krishna's pointing out here is that the essence of all the knowledge is the transcendental knowledge. So unless you can connect your branch of knowledge to the transcendental, you don't actually have knowledge. So without that, you can't, even the knowledge that's there doesn't actually have as much meaning. It means you have someone, he can be the best Ayurvedic physician and know the Ayurveda inside and out, but if he's not a devotee, he cannot know as much about the Ayurveda as a devotee. Because the devotee actually knows behind it why it works. The connections with the Lord. So he will have understandings and realizations that even a very, you know, renowned non-devotee Ayurvedic physician would not understand. Mm-hmm. So in the same way as all these branches of knowledge, they have to be connected to Krishna. If they are, they're useful. If they're not, they're useless. You know, they're useless just like any other branch of knowledge. So that's like Prabhupada mentioned to Prajumna. He wanted to learn more Sanskrit. And so Prabhupada was teaching in the Sanskrit that you could actually use it in Krishna's service. You could do the word for his books and like that. And Prajumna somehow or another was thinking that, well, if I want to learn Sanskrit, I need to go somewhere else. Right? He wasn't thinking, he somehow or another didn't understand that Prabhupada is the best Sanskrit scholar. You know, if you want to know more, you ask him. So then he mentioned to Prabhupada his idea to go to Varanasi and study Sanskrit. And said, Prabhupada said, yes, you can go to Varanasi and study Sanskrit, but it's 12 years. You have to go for 12 years, then you'll actually know Sanskrit. He says, yes, you can do that. He says, but if you want to help me, then you stay here and do what you're doing. So it's like, you want to get knowledge, yes, you go often, but you do it, you know, properly. But if you actually want to be useful in devotional service and actually do something of substance, then you stay right where you are and just continue doing what you're doing. So it's when the knowledge is connected. So that's what Krishna is doing here. He's showing how he's inside everything. You know, these ones here. I am the splendid of the splendor. You know, something new and freshly made and done very wonderfully, you know, you see it's very splendorous, very attractive. You know, it mentions here, beautiful, glorious, opulent. So all of your modern, especially your modern things are all along, I mean, before, anytime. Anything, what people generally spend money to fly all over the world to go look at is that. It's beautiful, it's opulent, it's glorious, splendorous. You know, or they're working for victory. You know, it's like, the whole one is watching something, some sport of some variety, and the moment you're waiting for is the end. Who wins? All along you're interested, but there's still that anxiety, who's going to win? But once that moment's come, then the whole fun's over. So the whole thing was there just to actually get to that point of Krishna at that moment, the victory. And all those people that are in the game, whatever it is, they're doing it just for that victory. They spend all that time just for that moment when they either make that final goal or that score that point or cross the finish line or whatever it is, that moment, that is the moment that they, that keeps them alive. But that's Krishna. So it's like Krishna showing how he's in everything. Adventure. People go off and go all over and go to the, you know, go off to the Congo and climb mountains and, you know, go deep sea diving. And it's all just for adventure. But that's Krishna. So what they're tasting is actually Krishna. It's not something else. But they don't know it. So Krishna is pointing out how he is what's inside everything. And then you can understand all these things. So it's like in the scriptures, there's always something hidden. Even if it's the material platform, you have the Karmakanda, there'll be hidden aspects of it. Because it's, in other words, it's training you in something hidden, to see the hidden point. You know, like the Hindu, he sees the rat, he thinks of Ganesh. So it's not wrong, you know. But it's that, so the point is that eventually you see that the hidden point is not Ganesh, because then what's in Ganesh? Ganesh's power is coming from putting the Srimadeva's feet on his head, the tumali. Tumali are those bumps. So there's always something. So Krishna is what is inside, right? He is the secret of secrets. He is the source of everything. It's all coming from him. So this point where you can see something in something else, that is there, as long as Krishna is the goal of that. And it's done through the proper channels that Krishna and the devotees give us. If we make up our own systems, mental speculation, or we don't follow the authorized systems, then that's useless. But the principle is all these different sacrifices that are there Krishna gives, then there's always these subtleties. So that's training us that there's something subtle behind. So Krishna here, his opulences, how to see his opulences in everything. Then one can see Krishna everywhere. From that comes full surrender. And then from that point of full surrender, then we can develop our pure love. Because until there's full surrender, there can't be full love. So then the whole process is bhakti, because our love is developing, though it's not full. Like that, because of the obstacle of material attachment up to the point of Brahma-bhuta. Therefore, it's called bhakti because the love is developing. But it's called, I mean, the whole process overall is called bhakti because of that. Even though within the process of bhakti we're doing sakama karma yoga, nishkama karma yoga, or the higher aspects of the advanced stages of yoga, yoga rudha, you know, where we actually start meditating upon the Lord and always absorbed in the Lord's holy name. Then those stages are there, but at least up to the Brahma-bhuta, the sakama, nishkama, still there's some obstacles because of the desire. So the full attachment for the material world hasn't gone. When that's complete, then it starts there that one can start to say, now it's actually fully devotional service, because now you're not removing attachments, now you're cultivating the love. Therefore you get these two definitions of bhakti. One meaning it starts from bhava on, and below that it's just sadhana. And the other, where the whole process is bhakti. Therefore Prabhupada and Baladeva will count this karma yoga as devotional service, as bhakti. Like that. You know? At the same time, Vishwanath then will point out, so that you are very careful to keep advancing and be very careful of what you're doing, then he shows you that it's all devotional service, you know, as a process. But technically the real bhakti, where there's no attachment to the material world and it's only now possible attachment to Krishna, then starts past this stage.
There's one tape I heard Srila Prabhupada talking, and he was on a morning walk. One Indian gentleman said to him, actually your disciples are all performing karma yoga, and the only one who's actually practicing bhakti yoga is you. You are the real bhakti yoga. said yes, but they're offering everything to me. So in this way, they're performing bhakti.
It's a nice point. You all heard? You all heard? Very good point. So that's the importance of the connection, because Krishna also mentions that one should, he's always mentioning associate with the devotees in here. Because that's how it happens. Because that's what is being described here. Means, in other words, there's the process of surrender. And there's actually the point at which the surrender has been achieved. This is, the Acharyas and Srila Prabhupada don't make any much distinction between the process for achieving and the achievement itself. So the six symptoms of surrender means we can be just starting those. We're practicing them. In other words, it's the six symptoms of surrender in practice or the six symptoms of surrender in actual achievement. So at when we come to the point where we actually are fully surrendered, means at basically the point of Brahma-Bhuta, at the platform of Bhava, then we've achieved fully that surrender. Like that. But before that, we're practicing it. Therefore, Vishwanath makes the distinction between sadhana bhakti, up to a sakti, then bhava bhakti, which is in between, prema bhakti, which is after. So then, it's prema bhakti is what we're trying to get to. Bhava bhakti is in between the two, because one has crossed the Brahma Bhuta platform. And now one is the how you say it? The development is very dynamic because one is working purely within the spiritual realm. But there is still the chance of some slight degree of some connection with the material nature, but it's very insignificant. So therefore it's still not pure bhakti, because pure bhakti means the absence of that, because it's pure unalloyed. But still there can be a slight touch of something in the bhava, like the, in other words, the reactions of previous offenses in that are still coming, though no offenses in that are being created. Like that. So there's still some aspects there. This is the platform of the Sarup city, or the Sarup city, but specifically this would be, I say, in the Bhav Sadhana from Shravandas, Varnadas, and Smarandas. But prema means apandas. So we know that only by the mercy of the Lord and His devotees can one cross from smarandas to apandas. Because then on the platform of prema, then basically one will not come down. Generally from there, one won't fall. But still within bhava there's the chance. So we see in this, the meditational aspects in bhava become the prominent. The chanting of the Lord's holy name and the total absorption in the Lord. So that's what Krishna was describing in the previous chapters. In the Dhyana Yoga, in the sixth chapter, he's explaining that the in the neophyte stage, or the beginning stage of Ashtanga Yoga, the yogi must perform his activities, his prescribed duties, Nishkam Karma Yoga. Then, after he's perfected Yama Niyama, Asanam, Pranayam, Pratyahara, and Dharana, where he's controlled his senses, he's detached from the world, when he starts the process of Dhyan and Samadhi, for those last two, the first six is considered beginning. He must perform Nishkam Karma Yoga. And then when he gets to that, then he doesn't have to perform those, and he can renounce and give up all prescribed duties and just chant and meditate on the Lord. In other words, he's a hamsa at this time. Like that. He has no connection to the world. So So then Krishna points out, either Krishna points out, or I don't remember, or one of the acharyas points out, that all these systems of yoga, one has to understand them, because they apply in bhakti. We don't sit down and hold the nose and do all those kinds of things. But those principles apply. So within the realm of sadhana bhakti, it means from shraddha up to asakti, nishkam karma has to be performed. That's Krishna's direction. And it's also supported by the other yoga shastras. So that's called yoga rurukshu. Means the beginning stages. So that means shraddha to asakti, which we call sadhana bhakti. So in the stage of sadhana bhakti, one must perform karma yoga. And Krishna says, of the two, then one should endeavor for nishkam karma yoga. Because if there's sakam, then that will still keep one within the realm of anarthas. One can't cross anartha nivritti. So crossing anartha nivritti, then one comes to nishkam karma yoga. And in that stage, then advancement is very quick because it's basically done on knowledge. The jnana aspect of the nishkam karma yoga, of the karma yoga is the prominent. Therefore it's called nishkam. While in the sakam, the karma aspect and the results are more important. And that you'll see, someone wants to get initiated because then they join the Orange Club or then they become, in with everybody else. They're part of the in crowd and all that. They're not thinking necessarily, ultimately going back to Godhead, but these things, like that, or, these different aspects. So one gets caught up in those things. And in Narta Navriti, one removes those. So then it comes to that stage. And then at that stage, the prominent feature is chanting and meditation on the Supreme Lord. Because in the platform of Swarup Siddhi, that's all one is doing. Serving Krishna in his spiritual form by meditation and chanting the holy names. And because of this, everybody thinks he's a madman because he's given up his prescribed duties. But as preachers, Gostiyanandis, even in that stage, one continues to perform the prescribed duties. Just like Krishna says, I have no work in this material world. But to set example, I do it. And he says, Arjuna, you should do the same. Right? Because Arjuna, it was, I think, at the beginning of the next chapter, he says, now I understand everything. That means he's come to the Brahma with the platform. But now he's going to go and fight. So even though now he's come to that platform, he's still going to practice Nishkam Karma Yoga because that is what everyone's going to do. Like Prabhupada, he was a sannyasi. He performed the duties of a sannyasi. He didn't not do them. He didn't transgress them. But he did the essence of them as given by his spiritual master. Like that. For the preacher, the Yukta Vairagya. So when that platform stays, so therefore all these systems of yoga that are explained in here, they can be taken in their external Vedic form is where the ritual and everything is seen as different from bhakti. Or they can be taken within their natural original form as part of the process of bhakti. In other words, karma, engaging the activities in the Lord's service, engaging one's knowledge in the Lord's service, engaging one's meditation in the Lord's service. That is the process to get us out of the material world. That is Krishna's path. Krishna says there's only one path. There's only one path. So this is the path. But there are those who are not devotees. So they follow the same path, but they do karma without the goal of Krishna. So then they go to the heavenly planets, because that's all they get out of it. The jnanis, then they take that path of the devotional process, and they only take the jnana. They don't connect it to Krishna, so they only get to the Brahman. It's like the devotee comes to the platform of understanding, I'm Brahman, I'm not the body. I'm soul, I'm eternal servant of Krishna. But because he understands that half of it, therefore, the process continues. It's a dynamic process. Right? The karma yogi, devotee, thinks, I am Krishna's service, I engage my activities in Krishna's service. So he performs activities, takes the material energy, gives it to Krishna, and he progresses. Because he understands the ultimate goal of I am serving the Krishna. So it takes one through. He comes to the platform of knowledge. He understands the workings of the material world. He becomes detached from it. He comes to the point of understanding I'm soul. But because he knows I am serving the Krishna, it goes beyond that. Then it goes into meditation on Krishna and full absorption in Krishna's holy name. But because he knows that the eternal pastimes and all that are where he's going, he continues. He doesn't merge into the Lord. The Patanjali yogi, he sees the Lord's form. He sees the Lord directly. He can speak to him. And what does he ask? Please let me merge. Because he doesn't know I am servant. So without that Sarup Lakshana, they get stuck. In other words, if you practice karma, jnana, or yoga without the Sarup Lakshana, then it's called Karmakanda section, Jnanakanda, and the Yoga Shastras and all these things. But the original process is for the devotional line. But it's been written in such a way by Vyasadeva in the Vedas and all that. This is what is called the flowery language of the Vedas. So those who don't want God will at least follow God indirectly. They don't know that they're actually worshipping God. They worship the demigod, but that power in the demigod to give what they want came from Krishna. They're worshipping the Brahman, but the Brahman is Krishna's effulgence. You know, the Paramatma is Krishna. It's not them. So they're indirectly worshipping, but they don't know it. So that's how they get called these things. And then even within Astanga, they don't go all the way. They only go up to the Hatha Yoga. So they're called Hatha Yogis. And then what was the one you were saying? Kriya Yogis. They just go for the mystic cities. They're not going beyond that. So whatever point the mystic cities come before Samadhi. You know? They come before Samadhi. They're quite down. They're still within the beginning stages, the Yoga Rukshu. They're not in the advanced stages. So they just go for that. You know, I think Raja Yogi is the one who's into pranayam. Just controlling the breath, making the mind peaceful. Like this. So you get all these different things. You know? The jnani is just into knowledge of Brahman, the material world, but he doesn't know beyond it. You know, if he's a Brahmavadi, he can get to the Brahman. If he's a Mayavadi, he doesn't get out of the material world. So it's all Krishna's one single path. And you can explain it in its pure form by the devotional process, Shraddha, Sadhu, Sangha, Bhajana, Kriya, and what's going on. Or you can connect it to these Vedic things. Therefore, Srila Prabhupada and the Acharyas can so easily and nicely say Vedic culture. You know? And they can give examples from the Bhagavatam, Mahabharata and all that have its form manifestation in a way that even the non-devotee followers of the Vedic culture will appreciate. They may not appreciate the pure original form that you see within the, you know, manifested in the, you know, the Vaishnava understanding, like that. They can appreciate these other aspects, but because the principles are the same, and the examples that they give have their connection in the original culture. Therefore, it's interchangeable. Therefore, you can say karma yoga and say bhakti yoga. It doesn't matter. Within bhakti yoga, we're on the platform or stage of karma yoga. Right? Or within that, we're in this stage of jnana yoga, or on jnana yoga, or on bhakti. You know? That's another confusing thing that you get in Vedic descriptions, as the Acharyas use it, is you'll call a section, that, let's say you have a section that's titled something, has a title, but the same that definition that uses the title can also appear as a portion of the ingredients of the overall, because generally it's the conclusion of it. Like when we say the process of bhakti, it includes karma, jnana, and yoga, but the conclusion when you come to it is bhakti. So we can call the whole thing bhakti or that section bhakti. So now it's just when we're defining it, it's whether we're defining it as the whole with so many sections in it, or we're just defining it as the section. So Vishwanath is generally describing from the platform, we're only talking to devotees anyway. So we understand the whole thing is devotion. But we're pointing out that in this point we're in Nisakam Karma Yoga, this point we're at Nishkam Karma Yoga, this point we're at Dhyana Yoga, this point we're at Bhakti. Just so you understand where you go. You know? In other words, Shraddha, Sarusanga, Bhajana Kriya, Anartha Nivriti, or at least the basis of the first four stages of Anartha Nivriti, there we're talking about Sakam. You know? At least the first three stages. Then from the other half, the third stage of the fourth stage, fourth, fifth, sixth, then we're starting to talk about Nishkam, because then one becomes steady, fixed in his devotional service. Then he gains a taste, because he's not interested in the material results. Na dhanam, na janam, na sundari. Asakti. I'm attached to Krishna. Like that. So that's Nishkam, he's still doing his services. Then when one comes to Bhava, then the Yoga Ruta, that advanced stages of just absorption and chanting and meditation comes with the Bhav Sadhana. Like that. Then that matures through those three stages of hearing about our transcendental form, being able to adjust with that and apply it in service. And we become fully absorbed in that meditation. That is also taken through the stages of Samadhi. It gives the different stages of yoga. Until one comes to the platform where one is accepted by the residents of the spiritual realm. In other words, before you've come by the grace of the spiritual master, by Krishna's grace, Krishna says here, he makes this point. I accept as my personal burden the supply of all the necessities, both material and spiritual. That means the facilities you need for spiritual advancement, which includes the Sarup Siddhi, Krishna's arranging that. So he's arranged that, and then you come through that point, you come up to the platform, and you're situated on that platform. You become fully absorbed in Samadhi. But you're still only dealing in the pastimes with the associates. You may see Krishna from a distance. You're picking flowers, doing whatever your services are, and you're associating with those. And when they see that your mentality is perfect, no desires at all, completely perfect, means one's given up the idea that, yes, I'm an advanced devotee. Because one is advanced. But even then, Krishna doesn't want his advanced devotees to think they're advanced. So as long as one thinks I'm advanced, then they see, oh, you still have the desire to be advanced devotees amongst those in the material, you know, the pastimes of the material world. So therefore, you have to stay back to take care of that. Because if you are an advanced devotee, you have the desire to be known as one. Therefore, the natural reciprocation is Krishna is going to reward that, and people are going to come and approach you. And you are, and you can benefit them greatly. So you'll stay in the material world as long as that's there. Even if Bhakti Vinod says, you know, it may be thousands of births. I'm not even sure that he doesn't use the word millions, but at least thousands he uses. So one can come up to the stage of Bhava, and right on the edge of that Samadhi, but not cross into Prema for thousands of births as long as he thinks I'm advanced. So when that stage goes, where one doesn't have that attachment, right? Because this is a spiritual attachment, it's not a material attachment. Then they say, well, why don't you stay here with us? Right? Then you go into Apandas, into Prema, and then when that's situated, you're working very nicely, then they say, why do you keep going back? There's no reason for you to go back. You just stay here. Then that is called, here we call it as death. And then, according to the stages of Bhav Sadhana, it's called Vasu Siddhi. Because now one becomes Nitya Siddhi. One's no longer on the material platform. So all these things can be explained within the yoga system. So Krishna's saying you have to know, you should know that. Because we're not on the higher platform. Once we're on beyond that platform, then there's another set of things you have to know. Then it's all just the rasa. In other words, this the Gita and all these explanations of yoga teach us how to destroy our attachments to the rasa of the material world. And the stages one goes through for that. At the same time, how to, by association of devotees, start to develop that attachment to Krishna, the rasa of Krishna, an attachment to serving Krishna. Right? So once that becomes fixed in asakti, then you can really seriously begin the process. Then you can fully absorb yourself in thinking of Krishna in that. Before that, not. Until that asakti is there, you can sit down and read about Krishna all day. It's not going to mean anything to you. Right? This is the point, is that the gopis, they see Krishna, you know, see him from a distance and that, they can think all day about that one point in time they saw Krishna. They don't have to have oceans of literature that describe all the intimate pastime to somehow or another keep their mind fixed on Krishna. You give them one thing, one look, one sound, one movement, they'll think all day about it. Why all day? Right? Krishna left Vrindavan when he was, 10 years, 8 months old. That means the residents of Vrindavan lived in separation for the next 115 years. So that means whatever association was there in that time, right? And Krishna's serious association with the gopis was from when he was 8 years old. So that means from 8 years old until 10 years, 8 months. That means 2 years and 8 months. And that, they were fully absorbed in for the next 115 years before all the pastimes are wound up and they left. So it's not quantity, it's quality. Therefore, until the sakti is attained, that full absorption isn't there. Therefore, the need for understanding these other aspects of yoga have to be there. Then it becomes the complete process. Then it becomes very nice. Then you see, that's why Srila Prabhupada and Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur are so comfortable just exchanging these terms. Because for them, the Vedic culture is only for this purpose. Though it does have elements to it that if someone's not a devotee, they can absorb themselves in it and think that they're getting somewhere. You know, like that. They're pious, okay, but that's all. But the essence, yeah. But sometimes devotees like to try to separate the two. But it's not. There's only the Vedic culture, which means devotional process. Then they have extra stuff that they've tacked on for non-devotees. Like that. So those things that are for devotees that fit into the process of yoga, in other words, the sadhana, yama, niyama, all these those things are there. The whole devotional process, you know, the Hari Bhakti Vilas, nectar devotion, they give all of these different aspects of rules and regulations, what to do and not to do, and that's all part of the system. So it works. It works very, very nicely. It works very, very well.
Earlier you were talking about Krishna entering the heart and giving realization. Sometimes we get realization or we get feeling enthusiasm from the deities.
From me?
Deities. So there's the glance that enters the heart.
That, the question. Question is that we were discussing that Krishna from within the heart then gives realization and gives that inspiration. So then if we're in front of the deity and then we get inspiration, is it the glance that gives the inspiration? So for the answer to this question, I will present this before you gentlemen, because you are always dealing with the deities, so you must know their intimate workings.
Prabhupada said that when this happens, he says, you should just take it as an act of mercy of the deity. Directly, he just likes something, he just wants to give his mercy, and it's just a direct action of mercy from the deity. He didn't say how well it's for his glance or whatever, he said it's just a direct act of mercy.
So Janani Das Prabhu said that Prabhupada mentioned when that happens, then when with the deity and get that inspiration, realization, and one should simply accept it as an act of the Lord's mercy. You know, he didn't get into detail if it's through glands, through this, through that. That's not so important. Because ultimately, see, Krishna is giving here. That's the interesting thing, is Krishna will give. Let's see, Bhagavatam will give the creation and all kinds of details, but only how much you need actually to make advancement. Beyond that, you don't. It's like the creation, it's important one has an understanding. It's very useful in that one understands how one thing comes from the other. Because then one becomes bewildered, you know, I do some activity, how does that happen? Well, the mind is thought at first, thinking, feeling, willing. So we see that in the creation, the mind is there, then after that come all the senses, which are connected to the gross elements. The senses, the sense objects, and the gross elements all are manifest after that. Those are all then dealt with by the mind. So if you can control the mind, then you can control the senses in the body. And then before the mind is manifest the intelligence. So if you can control the intelligence, that controls the mind. And if you can control, and then before that's manifest the ego. If you can control the ego, change that I am servant of Krishna, that controls the intelligence and the mind, the senses. And then, yeah. And so then if we change the consciousness, that changes all this. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur points out in the deity worship, you change the consciousness, you change all the bhutas. Right? Bhuta shuddhi in the deity worship means to purify the gross and subtle elements so that one is up to a platform where one can properly serve the Lord. So this bhuta shuddhi can be done either mechanically by taking each of the elements and everything and purifying it, or one can do it by this process. Start from the top, change the consciousness, and then it adjusts everything down. Therefore, he gives that if one contemplates this verse, Naham vipro na chan narapati napi vaishana shudro, because there it says, I'm none of these material identities. I am Gopi Bharti Pada Kamalayor Dasa Dasa Anandasa. I'm the servant of the servant of the servant of Krishna. So then that establishes I'm not this material elements and I'm serving the Krishna. So that actually accomplishes Bhuta Shuddhi. So when the whole fifth canto of Bhagavatam, then many times devotees kind of skip it, think of non-devotional, this, dry, boring, so many things. But we see if we actually look at it, it's full of all kinds of devotional stuff. If it wasn't, it wouldn't be in Bhagavatam. Right? Because those elements that can and bring out the understanding, so we understand how it works, how the material energy works, then how we can free ourselves from it is given. Because Krishna points out that this Nishkam Karma Yoga means it's based primarily on understanding. The jnana is the prominent aspect of Nishkam. Because one understands who he is, and the material nature and the relationship, and he's trying to understand the workings. That's why after explaining in the third chapter, Karma Yoga, then he's explained how to engage the activities. Not and thinking of him. Then he goes on to explain what that thinking of him and all these different things mean. Meaning with knowledge. So the fourth chapter is transcendental knowledge. He just gets into the jnana part of the Nishkam Karma Yoga. Then he puts them together in the fifth chapter. But we see the prominence is still on the jnana. Like that. The prominence is still on the jnana. Then he shows the next stage after that. So that takes us up to the fifth chapter. So in the sixth chapter he shows us, now that was all the beginning stages of yoga. This is yoga ruruksu. Now we're going to get into yoga rudha, the advanced stage. It means, in other words, the platform of Baba. In other words, you can say third, fourth, fifth, this is all describing sadhana bhakti. And then the sixth, though it gives the introduction of the whole yoga, Ashtanga yoga, its main thrust and conclusions are in the Baba and its position in prema. Then with these chapters, the middle six chapters, it's just discussing bhakti. Because one has to understand that Because that is the goal of the knowledge, goal of the activities, goal of the connection, the yoga. So the purposes of that karma, jnana, and yoga that you're performing in the devotional process, that is bhakti. Therefore, because you've connected it to bhakti, it becomes bhakti. If you don't connect it to bhakti, then it's called karma, jnana, yoga. But when it's connected to bhakti, it becomes bhakti. It's like you connect something to electricity, it becomes electricity. You put iron in fire, it's fire. One may point out it's iron and all that, and then, but it's fire. And when we say iron is fire, it says when you put iron in fire, it becomes fire. So, and then we say it'll burn just like fire. But now it says it becomes fire. So there is a stage as it warms up. That part closest to the fire becomes red first. You know, and then you can say it goes through its different stages of colors until it becomes, you know, it becomes a little bit orange and then it becomes more. And then when it actually becomes white, then it's like fire. You can take it out of fire. On its own, it'll have flames. So it's in fire. It's hot all the time. As soon as you put it, it's hot. So it reaches its full hot at the end. So when we describe the devotional process, it's bhakti. So the one is in the fire of bhakti. So it is devotional service. All one's activities, what one thinks, all that. But it's just a day of different stages. The beginning stages, that's not as hot as it is in the middle, and which is not as hot as at the end. So the perfectional stage at the end, when it's exactly like fire. Like that. So this is the different stages of the yoga process, or as Bhurijana always says, it's the yoga ladder. He calls it the yoga ladder. But then one can see how the Hari Bowls are here. Is there's that group of people that all they do is chant Hari Bol. You see them? They have that big drum. They just beat it boom, 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 boom. And all they do is that. They just go Hari Bol, Hari Bol, Hari Bol, Hari Bol, Hari Bol, Hari Bol. They don't do anything else. So if one understands, this is the mood of the Saraswatis. They're not caught up in the garb, either external dress or the vocabulary of all the, I say, you know, what is used in the Goswami literature and how the Goswamis would dress and like this. Because Saraswata means you understand what is their purpose. And their purpose is how to get people back to Godhead by this process of understanding the devotional process and engaging in it. Like that. So then they have no problem with it. So they can work in a modern environment, a contemporary environment that is non-Vedic. Means other one would say it's different. He changed it. He didn't actually change it. It's just that what had happened is others had not changed. Means the Goswamis and the Acharyas down to Bhaktivinoda Thakur, they were living in a contemporary environment and acting within their contemporary environment and preaching in their contemporary environment. You know, Narottam Das Thakur was preaching to the king. He made the king a devotee. You know, the king then made a decree, everyone in this kingdom must be a devotee. If you don't want to be a devotee, then you have to move out of the kingdom. You know, so he was preaching in his modern context. Jiva Goswami had gotten that was the commander-in-chief of Akbar's army to donate the land where the Goswamis lived. So he had a deed that said from, you know, Imlitala to what is it called? Vamsivat. There's the four trees. Imlitala, Vamsivat, Sringarvat. You know what's the fourth one? Can't remember what's the fourth. He said that land there belongs to Jiva Goswami. It was his land. Remember that? But he also, I think, is the one that donated for Man Singh. Yeah, he donated for Govindaji. I think he built Govindaji, and he gave that land because that was like his area to watch and take tax from and everything like that. So they were moving with the, you know, the, whatever was the contemporary scene, they were moving with the top of it. But when you came down to at the time of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, then the Vaishnavas, the so-called Vaishnavas, didn't change with the contemporary environment. They didn't know how to apply Yukta Vairagya. So they still ran around in their little rags and still did all kinds of, you know, things. Plus they were apasampradaya, they didn't know how to behave. And so all the intellectuals and cultured people rejected them. Like that. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur then starts showing how to, in the contemporary environment, preach. So there he was, pure devotee, grihastha, district magistrate, you know, philosopher. So then, in this way, he showed that one could, how to apply it in the situation, that situation. And then Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, so he showed how you live in the world like that. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur showed how you make the mat, how you make the full-time sadhus, how they establish themselves and preach in this contemporary environment. And Bhaktivinoda showed how the grihastha will live in this contemporary environment. So between both of them, you have very nicely established the temple and the congregation. Like this. So this mood of how we establish this, this is sunset. You know, therefore this mission in the modern context is Bhaktivinoda is the pioneer, because he showed how to take it out of the, how to take the Vedic culture and interface it into the modern world without compromising. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur showed how to take also the Vedic concept of the mat and the full-time preachers, brahmacharya sannyasis, and how to interface that. Then Srila Prabhupada's taken that and done it all over the world. They did it in India and he did it for the world. So then it becomes a perfect system. But so it's not been changed. Some will say it's been changed. No. The Goswamis were always preaching on the contemporary platform. Lord Chaitanya was preaching on the contemporary place. He was preaching to Muslims. You know, he was preaching to the kings and other people like this. He was dealing with all this. So the contemporary situation, Krishna here in the Gita is speaking in a very contemporary situation. They happen to be in the middle of a battlefield, and he's speaking there. He didn't say, oh, we have to leave this and go to the Himalayas and I'll tell you all this stuff. You know, so it's that's there. So the principle of Yukta Vairagya is very nicely explained by Rupa Goswami, and then very given perfect example for us by our acharyas. And then we see how to work, how to apply it, and it becomes very, very nice. So there is no, they don't have, therefore they have no problems in exchange, interchanging these things, because they know it means the same thing. You know? Like that. They don't mind exchanging, because it means the same. Just like if somebody says car, someone says automobile, someone says my wheels, someone says, you know, whatever they want to say, it all means the same thing. But depending upon the culture and the persons you're talking to, then you use a different thing. You don't go to some gentleman and start talking about your wheels like that. You talk about, you know, your automobile. You know, and just someone else, you just say my car. Like that. So, therefore, they have no problems because they know they're all the same. So saying karma yoga, saying sadhana bhakti, you know, like that, then has no problem for them. For them, it's not a difficulty. The principles given by Rupa Goswami, these principles given in the Gita, principles given in the Bhagavatam, they're the same. Principles given by Sanatana Goswami, like that, example given by Raghunath Das Goswami, it's the same. Just they've taken different aspects to bring them out, bring them to life for us. Like that. And then the acharyas show us nicely how to put that all together. It becomes a very complete package. Otherwise, then we can go on a long time, because Krishna makes the point, those who are doubtful, they don't get anywhere. makes that very strong. Like that. Yes.
So, a very contemporary example, a while ago there was a fire sacrifice in the temple. Very Vedic, and everyone was sitting around. The guy with that mud sitting there with him, but he had a computer on his lap.
Yes. This is. I've even seen devotees that when the screensaver comes on and the computer starts chanting Hare Krishna. So they even have the computers chanting. In other words, if one understands the principles, one can apply it in any place. It's just like if we take someone who is an expert cook, then, you know, you give them a clay pot, a stick, and a couple of bricks. You know, then basically they can get together and they can cook. But someone who's a good cook, but not necessarily an expert or a master, they won't be able to cook in that environment. Unless they have a, you know, a stove with six gas burners, you know, they're not even going to, you know, get into the kerosene or anything else. It has gas burners, and, you know, they got, you know, a walk-in refrigerator that anything they want's inside, and all different kinds of pots that someone else has washed anyway, and all these things. Then they can cook. But you tell them, okay, here you go. Here's a corner of the room on the floor. Here's four bricks. Here's a clay pot. Here's a stick. And there's some, you know, vegetables in that corner over there. And there's a few goutte outside. You know, a few cow dung patties out on the porch. Go for it. They'll just look at you and think you're crazy. You know? I say, this is not cooking. That's because they only know the detail of cooking that they know. They don't know the principles behind it. Otherwise, they would understand this is cooking, just in a very simple form. And they're used to a sophisticated form. So someone who knows the principles can apply it in any time, place, and circumstance without compromising the principles. And someone who only knows details, to them it'll be compromised. They'll have to adjust, but they'll have a tendency to compromise. So that's the art, is to not compromise the principles, but adjust the deep work with the details according to time, place, and circumstance. Then it becomes very live, dynamic. Okay, Swami, it's very quiet today. Question is that it's interesting. You notice that the kirtan is quieter than the lead singer. The question is the point being made that Krishna starts to remove all this ignorance when we become detached in our work, in our activities. So it's basically, it's going on. Once one starts devotional service, one is Krishna is interacting, he's taking part. Even with sakam bhakta, you know, desire for knowledge, desire for wealth, a desire for removal of disturbances, then Krishna's supplying. But he's also removing that detachment. So something's going on, but it'll be slower because the attachments are there, Krishna has to work against those. So it'll be slow. It'll definitely be slow. But one who is very serious about this, then it will go quicker. So Krishna here is pointing out one who is very serious. You know, he's saying that. One who is always engaged, one is like that. So then at that point, the obstacle may be there, but the devotee doesn't want to be attached to it. It just is there by habit. So then Krishna is removing. But you find that sometimes the devotee is attached to it. He wants his wealth, he wants his facility, he wants to be relieved of his anxieties, material anxieties. He wants some certain material knowledge. No. He wants that. So it's slower. That's why Krishna says that the jnani is the best, because he wants to serve the Lord. But it's still, he's performing nishkam karma. Well, before that is sakam. Because he wants to get rid of the anarthas. He wants to be detached like that. So naturally then things work quicker. Vishwanath says this stage, then it's like wind blowing, the storm blowing away leaves. So it goes a lot quicker. So it's like exponential. As you advance, the quickness of things going away and the advance of realization is exponential. It just becomes quicker and quicker. Like that. It's not just in a straight line. It's much, much more dynamic. Like that. So that would be my understanding there. That from the beginning, it's going on, but it'll be less. Because it's how much you turn to Krishna, then Krishna can deal with you. You know, if you turn to Krishna and recognize him, and then after 2 minutes turn your face away, Krishna can only deal with you that closely for 2 minutes. Other than that, you're doing what you like. And Krishna will be there, arrange. He'll give, like the father gives to the child. But then with the jnani, then he becomes like his very self. Because why very self? Because Krishna is performing his duties. Okay. Not his duties, he's performing prescribed duties. Without attachment. He never has attachment. And his whole thing is he's always thinking of devotees. So the jnani, he performs his prescribed duty without attachment, with knowledge of Krishna, always thinking of Krishna. Then he's now the same as Krishna. Krishna accepts him as the same as self. In quality he's the same, not in quantity, of course. But in his sphere of activity, he's following Krishna's example. He's doing what Krishna asks. So Krishna accepts him as the same. But that devotee who comes to the platform of pure devotion, pure unalloyed devotion, then Krishna accepts him as better than you. That is very, very dear. That's very special. So Krishna makes these three categories. You know? Those who be beginning devotional service, sakama, then more advanced, nishkama, then they actually come to, you know, the platform of solid bhakti, solid devotion. So then they become more and more dear, because Krishna is more dear to them. Because they're always thinking of Krishna, Krishna is always thinking of them. And when you don't think of Krishna so much, then he remains as neutral. Like that. So it'll go together as it goes. But here it seems to be specifically those who are very, very much. So it's being dynamically removed when they become fixed. In the what's it? It's the second chapter. It mentions no third. The one point of determination. Yeah, Vyavasayaktika Bhuti. Oh no, 241. It's 241. That Vyavasayaktika Bhuti, the becoming one pointed. So that is what we're trying to get to. Yeah. So basically, when one becomes fixed in devotional service, that's when that Bhuti is there. That's how you became fixed. You gave up your desires. Something is still there. Right? Something is still there. But it's the minor, it's not major. The mind brings them up, you throw them out. You don't work on them. While below that, when anishta bhakti or sakam, then they come up, you may go with them for a while, then figure out this is useless. But the nishkam is they come up and very quickly you throw them out. You know, so that the work, in other words, the work becomes dedicated to Krishna. You come to the stage of working for Krishna rather than giving the results to Krishna. Yeah. Like that. that I said very soon. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, the point is, I think Prabhupada mentioned, is that once one begins devotional service, then Krishna has tricked you. You know, now he won't let you go. Like that. So therefore, he calls, even if someone falls down, he's still saintly. He's done devotional service. So he's been situated on the correct path, but he's fallen from it. So he's better than unlimited, you know, pious karmis and jnanis and yogis. You know, you can put them all, it's just like this. I can take the whole shadow of the whole, you know, universe, right? And put it on one side of the scales. And I can take just one grain of sand and put it on the other, which will be heavier. Right? The sand. Even though it's so small. Right? So in the spiritual relation, one small, this littlest thing done for Krishna that is sat, that's more useful and valuable than all the pious activities of all the universes put together, because that's all asat. So unlimited quantities of asat cannot compare to even one fraction or portion of a drop of sat, of eternal, of devotional service. Therefore, this person is considered sadhu. They may not be acting as one, but we consider him as one. Right? Maybe socially when we interact, we have to interact according to their position that they're acting with. But we consider that they're sadhu, we consider that the service that they've done, and we don't forget that. Then we're able to actually act properly. Then it goes nicely. One always must remember that. So that's the point. Yeah, Krishna says here, a person may have a bona fide spiritual master and may be attached to a spiritual organization. But still, if he is not intelligent enough to make progress, then Krishna from within gives him instructions so that he may ultimately come to him without difficulty. The qualification is that a person always engage himself in Krishna consciousness and with love and devotion render all kinds of services. So one is, in other words, one is endeavoring for, one is trying to perform pure devotional service. Because that means one is fixed. Like that. If one has one's own so many other desires, then of course Krishna is fulfilling and he's going to be working to remove those. But then those who have really taken shelter, then he's going to reciprocate, because that's just what they want. Others don't want. You know, I've seen devotees with material desires don't want Krishna to too quickly take away their desires. They're worried about that. You know, I've got all this nice facility now, Krishna's going to take it all away. I worked so hard for it, this and that. They're worried about it, you know. Krishna, yeah, it's a little longer. Krishna, yeah. And he's waited unlimited, anadi. He can wait another, you know, few days or months or years or, you know, if you're not careful, lifetimes. So.
Krishna is removing all those things in the very beginning, we understand. But there also comes a point when one actually has a realization of Krishna's person, his presence. Realize that the person he is personally being. And as you realize that, what we can understand with knowledge of everything, even without our understanding, we can still remove it.
Yeah.
But later on, you can actually perceive that personality is there.
That is the that aspect of asakti means we've fully perceived Krishna as a person and we've become attached to him. that. We may not know, we may not have that deep of a relationship, but we become attached. You know, so that means if it's, that's come to that platform of the sakti, it's already starting before that. But there's definitely that difference, is that point. Generally when one becomes fixed in the service, then that starts to come. One starts to see. So that at that point when the anarthas are starting to, the anartha nivritti is very, how you say, is being well enacted. Then, because the desires, material desires are becoming less, then Krishna can start to play more of a prominent role. So at that point where we start to actually see Krishna as a person, understand that, you know, like that, then that's when the service, everything starts to dynamically pick up very quickly. You know, especially we see that and we take that. If we ignore them, it may not go so quickly. And that birth is the son of the maidservant. Then he was in the forest, and then a very wonderful Krishna's voice came to him and spoke to him. And then he went through the whole thing again and couldn't see again or hear. And he says, this life you won't see me anymore. Like that, but then he kept remembering that, and that brought him onto the point of perfection. And he came to the birth of Narad Muni. So that stage when one actually starts to understand, you know, factually, you know, as actual realization of Krishna as the person, then that's, things start to become very serious, much more serious then.
That stage is, what describes in the Bhagavatam almost, I'm not surprised, but almost comes.
Yeah. Because in Nasta Prayesu also we see is that even those who appear in Boma Vrindavan, there's still a little trace of something to remove. Very small. You know, it's not the activities, they have so much love for Krishna, like this. There's small little things. It's just the very subtle, like that. So Bhagavatam will bring to that. As when the Gita, when you heard, yeah. So when the mind is controlled, means it will always be thinking of Krishna. Then one will be always able to remember the Super Soul. You know? Then one can function on the platform of intelligence. You know? Then the Buddha Yoga is established very nicely, and then one comes to the Brahma Buddha platform. So from that platform, then one is always absorbed in the Lord. Yeah, one can only control the mind by thinking of Krishna. So then, as we think a little, we hear. This is why hearing process is important, because while we're hearing, then we're remembering Krishna. And then we've remembered Krishna, so that means the mind can be controlled that much more. So that makes remembering Krishna, again, more easy. So the more we associate with devotees and hear, then the more it becomes controlled. Yeah. Now Krishna is very... He's right, he just says he's of the, he's the, there is something where he says he's the, you know, he's the, of gambling on cheats, yeah. So he's the most clever. He cheats us out of our material desires and our material existence. Because we wanted it, he didn't want it. So then he tricks us out of that. You know, because it's simultaneously there. It means the same statement applies. The neophyte can gain benefit from it on his platform, and the Paramahamsa can gain inspiration and benefit on their platform. So the same verses, they have many times these layers of meanings. Like that. They have something just like Lord Chaitanya explained the Atmarama verse in 64 ways. It's not that there's only 64 meanings, but you know, that was enough to bewilder Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. Sarvabhauma was the greatest logician in India at the time, means on the planet. There was no one bigger than him. He explained 11 different meanings. So if he's explaining that, that means that's top of the line explanation. No one else is, right? He wouldn't, if he's going to have such a debate, he wouldn't have picked something just very easy. He would have picked like stuff that he's like the best at, the most qualified. You know, because he can see that this person he's talking to is very special. You know, all his bodily symptoms, the transcendental ecstasies he's in. So he tells everyone to leave the room. And then they discuss all these things. So he's discussing like his top realizations. And he's into Brahman realization. So the Atmarama verse is the most, is the essence of the, you know, Brahmavad or Mayavad philosophy. So he's explained his, you know, what he's understood from all his vast study. Right? We have to understand that he's Brihaspati. And Krishna says in here, of all the priests, he is Brihaspati. Means no one knows more than Brihaspati, except Brahma, of course. But so how much he knows? And he's given 11 meanings. Then not touching those 11, Lord Chaitanya gives 64. So how much is there? That Madhu also did a similar thing. He was doing, I think, the Vishnu Sahasranam. So he went through it once, gave a meaning for each word. Then he went back, gave again, and did this 40 times. And he's having his men sit there and write it down. Because he used to translate not with one scribe, but with many scribes. Because you can't write as quickly as you can speak, so he needed many people to write. So the first one would write the first word, the second one would write the second, the third, like this, and then he'd just go back. So after the 40th word meaning, they just said, you know, that's it, we can't handle anymore. His idea, he was going to do 108. But they just said 40 is enough, our mind can't handle anymore. You know? And these are great, you know, great, you know, philosophers and grammarians. So he's taking the words and breaking them up. Like Keshava means one with the nice curly hair, beautiful hair. Kesh is hair. Like here, but here Baladeva said, Ka means Brahma, Sha means Shiva, and Va means he binds them by his knowledge of devotion. So that means how much you have to know, what each syllable means. So like that. And so how much is in this, then it's all nicely done. Because Krishna is talking to a very broad audience. It's for everybody's benefit. So we see later we'll come down to when he gives the levels of surrender. You know? Then, after he goes past this sakam, which he considers that karma yoga is like, you know, that's where you really seriously start devotional service. He goes below that. That at least, you know, they're worshipping indirectly, they're moving in that direction, it's pious. It's better than just being a gross sense gratifier and not following the Vedic culture. So that will come up. So it's like, audience is broad. So he says the point, and it can be understood on so many levels. I think what's his name? Jiva Goswami. He makes that point about the Bhagavatam. Is that it has its direct meaning. It has its direct meaning. Hidden meaning. Right. says there's three main meanings you can get out of every verse. Direct means you just take the grammar as it is. And the indirect. Oh, direct, yeah, direct, indirect, and hidden. Like that. So he takes the first shloka of the Bhagavatam. Janmadyasyayataha. Like this. And he takes it as Krishna is born in Mathura, then he says what word and syllables there, then he orders his Vyasadeva to take him to Mathura. I mean, to take him to Vrindavan, then he goes there and he goes through all the different, all the whole pastimes of Krishna's life from his birth up to the end is all in that first shloka. And he just breaks, how he breaks the words and puts it that, and he gives the grammatical reasons and says, see, you know. So he's pointing out that it's not even that, you know, sometimes we'll say, you know, the Bhagavatam is transcendental because so many verses are about Krishna. But he's saying it's not that, he says every verse is about Krishna. Not even every verse, every word. Not even every word, every syllable. It's just you have to have the realization, the understanding how to get that out. Like that. You know? Therefore, someone who just says, well, they'll only read 10th canto, and up 10th canto, only the Vrindavan pastimes, doesn't have full understanding. You know? And invocation, which would be, you know, very much along the line of a Vedic presentation with the Gayatri mantra, Janmadyasya Yataha, like this. Then, you know, it starts off Vedanta Sutra, basically. But he takes it and turns it all into Krishna's pastimes. So like that. It just depends upon one's level of realization. So therefore Prabhupada and the Acharyas point out, be very careful of those who say only the advanced stuff is actually the real thing and everything else is, you know. If that was also the case, then what do you call it? Then Tungavidya, she missed the boat. Because somehow or another she knows all the Vedas, all the Puranas, Vedanta Sutra, all the grammar. It means what, all the 14 branches of knowledge, she's expert in all of them. That's why she's called Tungavidya. And when in the pastimes they need, then she'll bring out quotes or shlokas from here and there. And, you know, because sometimes they do that. Like there's one pastime when they steal Krishna's flute. And then, because of all that, they have names, you know, they have so many names. Like one Anuradha and these different. So these are also all nakshatras. And then it'll be taken and given to one of the other gopis, and then Krishna notices his flute missing, so immediately wants his flute. So then he goes to one person, and then they say, no, you have to go around the nakshatras in their order, how they go. You know, someone says, and this, no, but after this one is that one, and this, and that's all the different, these other different nicknames of the gopis. So in this way, then Krishna keeps going from one to the next, trying to get, but before he's going, they already know who's the next one, so they've already passed it on. So once he gets to the next nakshatra, that gopi's already passed it to the one after that. So this way then, you know, so they use these shastric things just in their pastimes to please Krishna. It's not for, they're not interested in jnana, but they have it all, they know. Even Madhu Mangal, one day he's eating, he starts talking about the rasa shastras. So it's actually the rasa shastras, they mentioned, you know, so many different levels. But I don't accept that, I only accept these things, you know. You know, he's talking about, oh, I think it's about the astika, the sattvika bhavas, like that. He says, when I see the food stuff, just put on my plate in front of me, freshly cooked and hot. It says, then all the hairs on my body stand on end. Then when I taste it, then, you know, I roll in ecstasy. And he just explains the whole Rasa Shastra, you know, of Bharat Muni, according to, you know, how he eats and all that. You know, it says, it's just like this. So they take all these things, and they're just part of the Rasa there. You know, Radharani goes to the sun temple to do the worship. Like that. So it's not they care about the sun god, but it's there that you worship the sun god. So she goes, she does it. You know? And like that, then she needs a Brahmin. Right? The rule is that the congregation doesn't do the puja, the pujaris do the puja. So then because of this rule, then Krishna can come as the Pujari. If the rule was everybody has spiritual opportunity and everybody can do just whatever anybody else does, then where's the rasa? Right? How do you establish exchange of rasa between people? How do you establish roles? Rasa means there must be roles. Roles means there must be restriction to keep it within that roles. Then one role can exchange with another. So it creates taste, rasa. Right? So if there's not this, then if Radharani can just go there herself and just do the puja herself, then where's the rasa? And Krishna can't come as the pujari. So because in her role as just one of the residents of the village, one of the Brahmins has to do the work. Then Krishna can come as the Brahmin, and then she can, then this way they can meet. Right in front of Jatila, right? Jatila is sitting there so happy that she's found this nice Brahmin to do this puja and tells him every day, you should do the puja for my daughter-in-law. And, you know, he's kind of like, well, let's see. That depends upon also, you know, what the, let's see what the dakshin is, you know? Like that. And then Madhu Mangal becomes the, how you say, the arbitrator there. You know, what he's going to give. So she pulls out a gold ring. He immediately snatches it and rolls it up in his dhoti. Okay, that's there. What else? You know, like this. So they have very nice pastime because you're supposed to get dakshin so these things can be done. So the whole Vedic culture, the Vedic knowledge is all there. But it's all there only for enhancing the pastimes because of the love is there. So they use it just as mediums for exchange. They're not bound by it. They're bound by the love, but not by these rules. But in the material world, because we don't have the love, we're bound by the rules. We get bound by the rules, because you only can get above the rules when there's love. That's the way they are in the spiritual realm. It means because of the love, the culture enhances that. Here there's no love, therefore the culture is going to evoke that. But it's only going to evoke it if we do it without attachment. Right? These are residents of the spiritual realm. They perform their prescribed duties just for pleasing Krishna. So it's pure unalloyed devotion. Here we don't have it, so we have to begin the process by doing it without attachment. Then it starts to invoke the devotion again in our heart. It reawakens the devotion. So it's a very nice, sublime thing, very directly connectable. On why it works from the original into its reflection, and then like that. So if one understands it, it's very easy to follow. Because it doesn't matter what role you take, if you do it for Krishna without desire for results, you get the same result. So it's spiritual, the spiritual facility, equality is there. Whether one's wearing a Brahmin's work or a Shudra's work, or whether one's a sannyasi, a brahmachari, a grihastha, it doesn't matter. It all is the medium through which you're going to please Krishna. So it doesn't matter. The gopis are pleasing Krishna. They're just cowherd girls. Right? So like that. They don't have any... He's pleased with that. Because they do their duties for Krishna. They always think of Krishna. Whatever they do, they're thinking of Krishna. While the yogic Brahmins are doing something that's supposed to be pleasing to Krishna, but they're not thinking of Krishna. So therefore, the performance of their activities is of no benefit. No benefit. Right? The wise got more benefit on taking the ingredients and giving it to Krishna. Right? They got the ultimate benefit. They became pure and alloyed devotees. So the rules are there to get us to Krishna. But Krishna doesn't say break the rules. Krishna says follow him for him without attachment. Then it's equal spiritual opportunity. Equal spiritual opportunity. Arjuna is a grihastha. Kshatriya, not only that, he's on the battlefield. So you can't get a more wild situation of having to deal with the material energy than that. And still, that is the process to become, come to the platform of pure and avoid devotional service. So if one just understands the process of sacrifice and accepts one's position and does that for Krishna, one becomes perfect, no matter who he is or what he is. So that's the point being made here. Everyone comes to that platform.
Someone was asking once about Archana and where it originates from, and I said, well, it originates in Oro. He said, how do you know that? I said, well, it's in the Gaurakovinda Leelamrita. And he said, Gaurakovinda Leelamrita doesn't discuss Archana. They just wrote it off like that.
It means whoever said that hasn't read Govinda Lila Mrita.
But he was supposed to have read it. But there's a whole description of Archana. This is
what Krishna talks about. He says action, inaction, inaction, and action. It means he read it many times, but he did not read it. Because the person doesn't understand what is deity worship in the first place. Otherwise, then one could see it there. Because the point is the Radharani goes to worship the sun god every day. Now what's that? And Nanda Baba in his house has a deity of Nisunga that he worships to protect Krishna and that, and he has Brahmins to do all the worship and all that. So that's where it comes from. And then that then reflects into Dwarka. And there we very much see all these kind of things, worship and Shaligram worship and the Brahmins and the temples and all this going on. Like that. Then we see this reflect into here. The point is that since we don't see Krishna's personal form, then he comes in the archa, and we do all the activities that the residents of the spiritual realm do. But because we don't know how to do it, because we don't have love, it doesn't spontaneously spring from our heart how to serve Krishna according to our rasa. Therefore, the rules and regulations are given so that it establishes properly how to do the service. Like the gopi, Krishna takes a bath, a Radharani takes a bath. They'll rinse their mouth, they'll brush their teeth with their twig, they'll clean their tongue, and then they'll rinse their mouth. Right? Then they'll rub their body with oils and, you know, these kinds of things. Then they'll wash with nice cool water. And after that they'll dry with a clean cloth. Right? Then they'll dress and do, that's what they do in the spiritual world. So what is deity worship? You do those things. Otherwise, if you don't know, if there's not rules, how do you know how to do it? How do you know whether you brush your teeth first or you bathe them first or, you know, that you do any of this at all? So the deity worship exactly parallels what's going on in the spiritual realm when Mother Yashoda or anybody bathes Krishna. You know?
There's a description when they enter into the green forest and the devi is given a description. What's happening? She's saying, just how see how the flowers are made, people carve it, people walk on Krishna's creation in the forest, and how everyone is welcoming you here. You see how the moonstones disappear like water, and they're mixing with the shamaki grains and the petals, and they're washing your feet with that. And it just goes on a whole description, and what it is, it's just ashram, shakatam, padyam. Exactly in the order we offer it here. It's exactly the same, but what it is the original, like the trees and the grass and the flowers, and they're all offering themselves to Krishna, and it's exactly the same order, Madhupaka and the honey dripping from the trees.
Because that's where, that is worship, and that's where it comes from. But there it's in devotion, and here it's in the rules. So they'll say, well, there it's not done in rules and regulation. It means they don't understand the reflection. You know? So this person saying it's not there is totally stuck in rules and regulations.
Oh, but he's beyond that.
Huh?
He's beyond that.
Everyone has the right to say whatever they like, but then reality is something else. You know? Like that. Reality is reality. Point is one can say it's not there. But that's where the origin is. Otherwise, where's the material world? Where's the origin? It's in Krishna and Vrindavan. And if you say, no, it's not, there's no creation going on there, then that means you don't understand. The whole thing is we like to separate, because we want to say this is a lower scripture and this is a lower understanding, this is a higher and I have this higher. But the point is that the highest understanding is you can see from the top to the bottom, and that's what the acharyas are pointing out. You know? Just like Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, when he discusses Bhav Sadhana, the first point is Shravandas. You hear about your relationship with Krishna. So he stretches that to include when you first come in contact with devotees or the Shastra that tells you that we are the eternal servant of the Lord. So when he and Srila Prabhupada discuss the Shravandas, Varnadas, and Smarandas, they discuss it from Shraddha, Sarusanga, Bhajana Kriya from there. Well, you'll find most will only discuss it from the platform of Bhava, within Bhava itself, and that's it. And they'll say beyond that, it's not there. But the point is the Diksha Guru, his duties start with telling you, or how you say, connecting you with the process by which you can understand the Lord's form, and that you are, that the Lord is non-different from the Lord, and that you are Krishna's eternal servant. It gives you that opportunity, your adhikar, to worship. And that the perfection of that is when you come to the platform of being engaged in your transcendental sarup in the spiritual realm. That's the full spectrum of the Diksha Guru's work. So someone who understands all that then can understand that these definitions extend that far. It may not be fully manifest. Just like someone who doesn't really know cooking will just say that when things are in the pot, it's cooking. But someone who knows cooking knows before that, then you got to go market and do all the things before and cut up the vegetables and prepare everything. So you say it's cooking. So someone who says the one is cooking, the other is not cooking, doesn't know. Someone who you know, just says that what they're doing, the preliminary work to the actual putting things in the pot, and they're satisfied with that and thinks that's cooking, doesn't know. Someone who understands the whole thing is cooking, but at the same time knows the essence of the cooking is when it's actually in the pot cooking. And it reaches its perfection when the preparation is ready. Knows the whole thing. That's the point. So we see that you know, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was very strong on this point. And because of this, he didn't endear himself to the, you know, the caste Goswamis and the Babajis and these kinds of persons, because they just want to establish themselves as very elevated, because they only deal with these very elevated scriptures. But their dogmatic views on only it's this way shows that they're not on that platform. They're on the platform of Vaidhi. Right? You know, you check any of these persons. What are their complaints about us? You know, we don't dress properly, we don't eat properly, we don't do this, that. What's that? That's all Vaidhi. All their complaints are about our Vaidhi. At the same time as they'll say, oh, we're on the topmost platform. They're totally absorbed in Vaidhi. Totally. But they think they're on, you know, Rag or Bhava. No question. Padma was saying the other day, a very interesting point he gave to prove that. I don't remember. He had a very nice point. I think Bhaktivinoda Thakur makes a point. But it's just their mental concoction, that's all. They've made their own religious system. So they're not actually Rupa Nugas. You know? Just because you've taken Rupa Goswami's book and then, you know, you quote things from there doesn't mean. Just like you take the Vedas. From the Vedas you get six philosophers. Five of them are bogus. One of them is real. So the Uttara Mimamsa, or Vedanta, is real. The others, Purva Mimamsa and Vaisheshika and Gotama and all these different things, Nyaya, they're all bogus. But they quote the Veda. They base everything that they say on Vedic verses. They can say this point this, this point this, this point this, but they don't have a complete understanding. They don't know how it all comes together. Well, then the devotee, so then those who follow Vedanta understand. So in this way you get apasampradaya. Apasampradaya means that they may quote the same scriptures, but they're not actually following the actual mood that was given. So the point, it's not the points they make aren't in some way correct, but not the way they're presenting. They've missed the point. They say the archana is not there. They don't understand. Archana means you worship the Lord. You offer your worship. So since we don't have love, we do it through Vaidhi. But that just matures until you directly see the deity. Sanatana Goswami is also, he's talking with the deity. He's directly his deity. He's still offering him, some burnt chapatis without salt. So he's still making offerings and puts him to rest and wakes him up and does all these different things. So that's archana. But he's directly seeing his Krishna. So the same thing's going on in the spiritual realm. I think Prabhupada makes one purport where the Lord of the heart comes outside. I think in the Rasa dance he was talking. Paramatma in their heart, then he came out between each of the gopis. So each of the gopi, thought that they were dancing with Krishna alone. So he says, you're so kind, instead of just manifesting inside, he manifests outside. So that's the perfection of the deity worship. It means your Ishtadev, or your Lord of your life, Lord of your heart, is manifest in front of you, and you are able, through the servants of the Lord, to serve. So properly understood and performed deity worship culminates in rendering service to Krishna and Vrindavan. In the mood of the residents of Vrindavan. This is, you gave example there of the 69 items being offered. There's also other times when they mention 69 items. But in different pastimes. So it's not an uncommon theme. It's a very common theme. That these 16 items are being offered. So the concept of the 16 comes from there. Comes from Golok, but it was without rules. It just happens naturally, spontaneously. Then in Dwarka, then it comes under the purview of rules. When you worship Krishna, but there's still some attachment to the rules, then you end up in Dwarka. But if you worship without the attachment to the rules, then you end up in Vrindavan. That doesn't mean you don't follow them, but you're not attached to them. So these persons, that they're very attached to the rules, so it would be very hard to prove that they're actually, their destination is Raja Vrindavan. It would be very hard to... It would be very hard to prove that. It would be hard to prove even that sometimes they're on a proper path, but they're actually on the solid devotional path as given to us by the Acharyas. This point. Etamsa astaya paratmanishtam adyasatam purvatam adam kadhi. Aham tarishami durantaparam tamam kundam nagashivaka. Shall cross over this insurmountable ocean of meshes by being firmly fixed in the devotional service of Lord Krishna. This process is approved by the previous authorities who are all fixed in firm devotion to the Lord. So they've approved this process, and they were fixed in that process. So this process that's being, these processes that we hear come up about, just being advanced things, there's no connection between the advanced and the basics. This doesn't sound like the process that the previous acharyas were fixed in. So it becomes very hard to relate the whole thing. clear. Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivrinda ki, Jai Nitai Gaur.